This is Alex Linder. Welcome to Radio Estina for today, September 11th, 2008. This is show number 24. It will be archived and up within 24 hours. And as we've discussed on earlier shows, today we're going to talk about a couple of articles related to the Jews in the U.S., and then we're going to talk about a big court case in the 1930s. As we continue our look into the Jewing of America in the 20th century. And again, it will be our example will be taken from Culture Wars magazine. That's E. Michael Jones magazine. You can find it at culturewars.com. And that involved a bunch of black teenagers accused of rape and the various implications of that. It took place in Alabama and became a big court case along the lines of what we talked about earlier in relation to both Leo Frank, the Jew who raped and murdered Mary Fagan, and the attempt to spring him to get him off the hook carried out by his fellow Jews led to the formation of the ADL, America's Foremost Hate Group. And also the undermining of black nationalism in the U.S. and the attempted forced racial mixing, which would lead to what was good for the Jews, which is the disintegration of solid, unified, ethnically homogenous, culturally unified America, and it's turning into a multicultural mess, which is what we have today. So, that said, and I'm working on this sound levels here to try to get them right. first article we want to talk about today is, let's see here. I want to talk before we get to the main piece. I want to talk about a couple of articles that show the Jewish mentality. And one of these is an AP report on Jews in small-town America and how they're trying to lure fellow Jews down to their area. Now, this is an AP article that came out a few days ago or within the last week about Jews trying to recruit Jews to Dothan, Alabama. Larry Bloomberg is looking for a few good Jews to move his corner of the Bible Belt. And just some of the characterizations in this. We have Jews at the AP writing about Jews in Alabama trying to bring other Jews into their failing community, their small and disappearing community. And just some of the characterizations. This shows what happens when you allow an outside group to come in and take over your media and to spread lies about who you are to your own people until they don't even recognize themselves anymore. It says Dothan is it's a little town in southeast Alabama, so it's right above the Florida Panhandle, 80 miles from the beaches, and they've got about 58,000 people there, and they call themselves the peanut capital of the world. And they're basically trying to bribe Jews with $50,000 to get their Jewish families to come down there and stay there for 5 years. Now, where did Jews get that kind of money? Well, a lot of it is taken from you and your kind illegally, filtered through the government, or simply outright stolen. It says more Jews are living in the South than ever, about 386,000 at last count in 2001, according to Stuart Rockoff, a historian at the Goldring Woldenberg Institute of Southern Jewish Life in Jackson, Mississippi. So one Jew, three organizations. But young Jews are leaving small places like Dothan in favor of cities like Alabama and Birmingham. Jews are always drawn to big cities, and big cities are always where any kind of freak or pervert is drawn, because they can't find their own in the small towns as easily as they can in a big city. So Jews, homosexuals, and deviants of a thousand disgusting ilk are always drawn to the cesspools, the large cities. A lot of the older Jews have died, and not many of the younger ones have stayed, said Thelma Nomberg, a member of the Dothan Temple, who grew up in nearby Ozark, where she was the only Jewish student in public schools in the 1940s. We are dying. But being outside the Christian majority was never a problem, Nomberg said. Even six decades ago, she won the Miss Ozark beauty pageant at 14 and sometimes attended church with friends after sleepovers. Now a widow, Nomberg has watched two of her four adult children leave for Florida as Temple Emmanuel has lost nearly half its membership, down to about 50 families. She can only hope the recruitment plan hatched by the Bloomberg Family Jewish Community Services of Dothan works for her synagogue. So these Jews down there in Dothan, Alabama, are advertising in Boston, Miami, Providence, Rhode Island, and Washington, D.C., and plan to expand their campaign in order to attract Jewish families with the allure of $50,000 if they move to Dothan, Alabama. I think it's important that we try to find young people that we can use at our religious school, our Sunday school, and help in the way of trying to create more of a family-type atmosphere in our temple, Bloomberg said. Groups offered financial aid for Jews to return to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, and Jewish organizations around the country offer moving assistance for relocating families. Congregation has loans and other benefits for Jewish families moving into an area near Boston. Lots of great benefits when you're a Jew, huh? All of them officially approved as, 501c3 educational or foundations. Perfectly okay, wonderful, what have you. But if you try to do something white, those same Jews that found these organizations and give themselves all kind of tax breaks and advantages, it will call you a hater and say that yours can't be allowed, just as William Pierce was denied 501c3 status for his organization, the Cosmotheist Church. Now, let's look a little longer. Now we get to some of the characterization. Trying to lure Jewish families to a quiet southern town in a state with a reputation for hard right politics and racial intolerance might be difficult. Okay, you ever seen Israel described as racially intolerant? Even though they build a wall around their state to keep them away from their genetic kin, the Palestinians, or the native Palestinians there? No, you haven't. But they feel free to characterize our people and our cities and our states in a way that serves their interests. So we're intolerant if we want to protect our sons and daughters from marauding niggers, as we'll find in our coming stories. It's intolerant of us to want to protect ourselves. It's hateful of us to want to exist as a separate people. So whenever we resist the oppressor's attempt to define us and control us, we become the bad guys, and our notoriety is spread through their media using only terms that they approve. Never are we allowed to call ourselves what we are. Always we must accept their abuse labels. It's a small community, but they have some deep pockets to be able to do this, said Rockoff. As a historian, it's fascinating to see them trying to buck this trend. So we have a quiet southern town in a state with a reputation for hard right politics and racial intolerance. That's one thing. And then below, we have another. The Northeast, Rabbi Lynn Goldsmith, female rabbi, didn't know quite what to expect when she moved to Dothan a year ago to lead the congregation at Temple Emmanuel, which was founded in 1929. She came with her husband, who directs the Jewish Community Services Group. A Connecticut native, the rabbi halfway expected Alabama, the Alabama of old, with wide-open racism and dirt roads. The Northeast has a really warped perception of what the South is all about, and I found out it was all wrong, she said. The South is a wonderful place to be. The people are warm and friendly. There's very little traffic. And best of all, there's no snow. And that's accurate, but what they don't tell you is that perception of the South is created by the Northerners and the Jews, main among them. So they're working against stereotypes that they've created and spread to grow their little colony of hate-filled kikes down in Dothan, Alabama. That's one article about Jews that appeared recently in the AP. Now let's talk about another one, in which the hatred for whites is even more blatant and widespread. And we see that it's not just Southern whites Jews hate, it's all whites. It's not just America they hate, they hate anything opposed to their version of what America is supposed to be. And this is an article that appeared in the Washington Post, written by a Harold Meyerson, who we can safely assume is a Jew. He's got a really ugly looking face. And this is about the presidential race. And it's got kind of a characterization of the people who support John McCain and the Republican Party. And he's saying it's a party of white people, and white people are the past, and niggers and Jews and diversity in the third world and multiculturalism are the future. Same thing we always hear from official sources. They always must defame the past and defame the people who created America. Americans are white by definition. Whites created America. The Indians who killed off our ancestors, the Salutrians, were not Americans. We named it America. He says, Harold Meyerson, writing in the Washington Post, September 3rd, 2008, says, "Maybe it's a good thing for Republicans that Hurricane Gustav has abbreviated their convention. On an issue of some concern to America and the economy, they seem to have nothing to say." Let's see. And actually, although the article is about the economy mainly, in the end he gets to his main point at the bottom, just as in the bottom of the Alabama article, we see the slurs against the South. "The economy is not all. The GOP's last best hope remains identity politics. In a year when the Democrats have an African-American presidential nominee, the Republicans, now more than ever, are the white folks' party, the party that delays the advent of our multicultural future." Think about that, the delays. So we're an obstruction. Whites are an obstruction. We're delaying the advent of our multicultural future, the party of the American past. Republican conventions have long been bastions of de facto Caucasian exclusivity, but coming right after the diversity of Denver, this year's GOP convention is almost shockingly, un-Americanly white. So they're the real America. They can come in here and they can redefine us and claim that America's a melting pot and claim that we're a nation of immigrants and claim that we have to open the borders to everybody, and now they can call us un-America, we who founded America. The GOP convention is almost shockingly, un-Americanly white. Long term, this whiteness is a huge problem. This year, however, whiteness is the only way Republicans cling to power. So he means that as we import more and more of these millions and millions of sewage people from the third world, the Republicans aren't going to be able to win. It's going to be a huge problem for them that they appeal only to whites. But this year, however, whiteness is the only way Republicans cling to power. If the election is about the economy, they're cooked, and their silence this week and nearly all things economic means that they know it. So the Jew is kind of putting in pretty open terms what his group feels, which is that we have to destroy the white majority in every white country, and not just in America, but all around the world. I saw an article from a Finn who's in America because he's being politically persecuted for speaking out against Somalis gang-raping Finns. And the elite in that country have a plan to import a couple of million niggers from Africa into Finland because it's not diverse enough. And, you know, they use the pretext of our population is aging and declining and we need to make sure that we have enough workers to support people in their old age. All around the world, white people face the same problem. It's caused by the same other group and it comes from the same source. The source is Jews. And Jews hate whites. They are not simply white people with a different religion. They are non-whites. and they hate whites just as blacks and Mexicans hate whites. And the Jews use the blacks and Mexicans to destroy the white communities. Now, let's drop that and let's go ahead and let's talk about the, I'll do a little more history let's talk about the Scottsboro Boys and continuation of the carry the war into Africa idea. This is the let's turn the Negroes in America from humble conservative Christians into violent communist revolutionaries. That will be good for Jews. And we'll seize upon any case that we can and exploit our control of the mass media to portray the niggers as victims and the South as evil for resisting and trying to defend itself as a cultural and racial entity. And that's what the Jews did over the course of the 20th century. You can see where we are today, looking out your window. Now, this article is from the July-August issue of Culture Wars, and it's an article by E. Michael Jones, whose books we've discussed many times, and you can find out all about his magazine at culturewars.com. It's pretty good stuff. He's a Catholic. I don't know that he'd even call himself a traditionalist Catholic, but he's open to criticism of the Jews and has written a couple long books talking about Jew-led revolutionary movements. And we know from the authoritarian personnel and other sources that Jews see as a couple of their prime ways for breaking down white society are to introduce the idea that promiscuity is cool and sexual immorality is cool and that will lead to revolution, and also to set race against race, so that in any white society in which they've worked out a way of politically acknowledging through law the fact that the races are different and irreconcilable, i.e. apartheid, segregation, Jim Crow, what have you, the Jews work to overturn that and to force what they call integration, even though that's a euphemism for disintegration. We don't need niggers integrated to make us whole. Integrity, integration of the same root. Niggers rather disrupt and destroy what the whites create because they're a different type of being. And in that regard, even E. Michael Jones is wrong in that the Catholic Church's doctrine is that race doesn't matter, races are equal before God. And that sort of universalism leads to, it plays in very nicely with the Jewish revolutionary movement, even if the Catholics aren't overtly, or in years past weren't overtly, opposed to, say, ethnic parishes and laws relating to discrimination. Their universalism philosophically leaves them open in the same way that the Enlightenment philosophies that they denounce leave whites open to being preyed on by people who aren't interested in the facts of the matter. Now, all right, so this is the story of the Scottsboro Boys, and the big picture here is Jews have come into America in the period 1880 to 1920. And these are primarily Jews from Eastern Europe. And they're moving into schools and hotels that were formerly wouldn't allow them. They don't like that. They're coming into a place where they're looked down upon as kind of scum, which is because they are scum. And so they're discriminated against at universities and they're discriminated against at hotels. Nevertheless, they're still allowed into the universities, maybe not in as great numbers as they'd like, but there's lots more complaining about the problems they face than the reality of it. Anyway, they're coming in, they're founding new academic disciplines, as we've talked about, anthropology, and they're spreading through the teacher schools. They're spreading their bogus ideas that race does not exist, being one of the principal, that America is a nation of immigrants. It has nothing to do with race. They're spreading this through the media and the increasing number of academic positions they occupy. Whatever is good for Jews is what they're preaching, and abolishing the white race is their ultimate mission. That's what they're trying to carry out. They want Israel to rule the rest of the nations, and so part of this is inflaming blacks, the descendants of the slaves, against the whites, whereas the blacks and the whites have reached a modus vivendi, a way of living together in the wake of the Civil War, and the Northerners appointing the blacks to positions they can't earn and aren't fit to fill. The South has come up with ways of dealing with these and ways of protecting itself from these otherwise violent, stupid jungle animals known as blacks. And so it's the Jews' mission, the Jews primarily coming down from the big cities in the North to lecture, harass, and browbeat the South. The Jews are going to do whatever they can to upset this state of things. And they've now, by the 1930s, they've been in the country long enough to where they have some power. They have more than they had in 1915, when they were almost able to get their own rapist and murderer, Leo Frank, excused from his from the legal consequences, i.e., his execution for pedophilia and murder. They tried to get him off. They ran long campaigns. We talked about that in the last two issues of Radio Estina, 23 and 22. Now in 24, we're going to talk about a case another 15 years later, moved from 1915 in the Leo Frank trial to the 1930s and the Scottsboro Boys. Now, E. Michael Jones says, what you have here is you have a couple of white women. You have the Great Depression as the backdrop here. You have all kinds of poor people in the South and in the North moving about by freight trains. And you had a couple of women, not of real high character, at least one of them was basically a prostitute, dressed as males. And they, and along with real white males, get into a fight with a bunch of blacks. The blacks win the fight, throw them all off the train, except for the women. And when the train finally stops and meets the police, the women claim they're raped, and this sets in motion a long trial. And the Jews try to Jew the South in just exactly the way they did in the Leo Frank case, where they spread all kinds of nasty characterizations of the South. And so that's what we're going to find, but let's see what Jones has to say. He says, and I want to say that before I start this, I want to say that last week, or we intended to do this on Tuesday, but we had a technical problem, so we delayed it till today, Thursday. But we will be back to our regular time on Tuesday of next week, and also moving forward. So know that. Now, Jones says, he says, on March 25th, 1931, Victoria Price and her companion, Ruby Bates, so these are the two white women involved, Victoria Price, Ruby Bates, hopped on a freight train in Chattanooga, Tennessee, bound for Huntsville, Alabama. Both women were white, both were dressed in men's clothing, but Price was considerably older than Bates, who was still a minor at the time. Price and Bates were not alone in the train, nor was it unusual to find that freight trains, in the heart of the Depression, had become the poor man's passenger rail. 200,000 people could be found riding the rails at any one time during the 30s, and hobo jungles had sprung up at freight yards across the country to accommodate the nation's poor and dispossessed on their way to look for work or to no place in particular. Accommodations on freight trains in the South were not segregated, a fact which led to what might be called segregation from the ground up. When a gang of white youths met a gang of Negroes on a freight train which was traveling from Chattanooga to Huntsville, a fight ensued, and over the course of the fight, as the train was picking up speed, the Negro youths, who eventually triumphed, threw the white boys off the train one by one until finally there was only one left, and the train was now moving 35 miles per hour. Rather than throw him off the train to what would have been severe injury and possibly death, the black youths let the last white boy stay on the train, and then they turned their attention to the other two youths, who it turned out were women in men's clothing. What happened at this point has been a matter of conjecture for the past 70-some years. When the train pulled into the small town of Paint Rock, Alabama, town probably very much like Dothan, a posse was there to meet it. Angered by their treatment at the hands of the black youths who had thrown them off the train, the white boys had informed the station master, who telephoned the police, and when the train stopped in Paint Rock, the posse surrounded the train and apprehended the nine young black men. It was then that the posse discovered the two women dressed like men. Victoria Price, the older of the two, immediately charged the Negroes with rape. The two women were taken to a local doctor to be examined. The Negroes were taken to jail, and the stage was set for what would eventually become the most famous trial of the 1930s in America, the trial of a group of Negroes, youths who became known as the Scottsboro Boys. The Scottsboro Boys trial was a golden opportunity for the NAACP. Remember, that's a Jewish false front. It's ostensibly a black organization, but it's set up and run by Jews, using quadroons and octoroons, that is, light-skinned, white-looking Negroes, as their speakers and their frontmen. So, the Scottsboro Boys trial was a golden opportunity for the NAACP, says Jones, because of the fact it was a trial and the NAACP specialized in litigation. The NAACP had experienced one of its greatest victories in January 1923 when the U.S. Supreme Court declared that 12 sharecroppers accused of murder and insurrection in Lane, Arkansas had been denied a fair trial. That decision proved vindication for Lewis Marshall. And you may remember him for being very active in the movement to free the pederast murderer Leo Frank, the Jew. So 8 years after Frank couldn't get the Supreme Court to hear the appeal on the Frank case, 8 years later he's able to get off 12 sharecroppers on the basis that they've been denied a fair trial. So by April of 1925, all the original defendants had been released, prompting W.E.B. Du Bois, who's the black face in the front of the NAACP, with the Jews behind him, to claim that the release of the Lane 12 was, quote, a complete victory for the NAACP, unquote. By 1931, so another 6 years later after these 12 in Lane, Arkansas, by 1931, when the 9 Negro boys were apprehended in Paint Rock, Alabama, legal victories rang hollow in a world where unemployment, hunger, and the specter of starvation, in short, economics, had become the real issues. The NAACP itself had narrowly avoided economic extinction when contributions plummeted in the wake of the stock market crash of 1929. By 1930, their situation had become desperate, prompting William Rosenwald offered to donate $1,000 per year for the next 3 years if 4 other donors agreed to do the same. So, you have the Great Depression, and it's taking the very richest Jews to come together to save the NAACP, the Jewish False Front, ostensibly representing blacks, but really representing what's good for Jews. What's good for Jews is that blacks be used to integrate America, rather than blacks stick together economically and advance themselves the way the Jews have done. Because the blacks are just political tools to be used by the Jews. And the Jews don't care about their true interests. Eventually, Herbert Lehman, Mary Fells, Felix Warburg, and Harold Ginsburg, publisher of the Viking Press, came forward and matched Rosenwald's grant, and the $16,350 which the Rosenwald plan brought in allowed the NAACP to weather the financial crisis of the 30s. Murray Friedman points out that Edsel Ford was the only non-Jew to respond to Walter White's SOS, a fact which prompted Du Bois to admit that only the strength of the communal Jewish resources permitted such a degree of financial support. So as it is today in Dothan, where the Jews can afford to spend $50,000 a Jew family to increase their numbers in a tiny southern town, so it was yesterday in the 1930s when rich Jews would come together and donate $1,000 a year apiece to save the NAACP. Says Jones, not even the fact that New York Jews had to band together and save the NAACP during the Depression could move that organization away from its resolute avoidance of dealing with economic issues. The fact that the Negro in the 30s was affected by the financial crisis more than white Americans had no effect on the NAACP's philosophy of judicial activism. As a result, in the aftermath of the stock market crash of 1929, the Communist Party gained the upper hand over the NAACP because they were willing to talk about the economic dimensions of racial discrimination in a way that the NAACP was not. So again, a slightly different group of Jews, the Communists and the other Jews who were pushing the NAACP, they're somewhat at odds and they somewhat have the same intentions. They both want to use the blacks as a revolutionary tool, turn the black into a revolutionary in the South, destroy the white man's South, destroy the white man's country, take it over, and let Jew thinking dominate everywhere. 30 years later, the black historian Harold Cruz would claim that the Depression revealed the bankruptcy of the NAACP approach. The economic disaster, says Cruz of 1929, had revealed clearly that the guiding white philosophy of non-economic liberalism was insidiously debilitating leadership ideal to have been imposed on a non-white minority group seeking racial parity under American capitalism. Worse than that, non-economic liberalism was a seductive entrapment into a fixed psychology of dependence, underdevelopment of social intelligence, and intellectual subservience. So he's saying essentially what Bill Cosby says, you know, the Jews put the chip on the black shoulder and encourage them to blame whites for all their problems and look for political solutions from the courts, rather than working, making and saving money, and putting that money back to work in the black community. And through that, through economic empowerment and economic solidarity, advancing the cause of their race. Jews want what's good for Jews. They don't care about what's good for any other group, white or black. Says Cruz, at best the free market of capitalist economic activity was free for whites only, and even then it was only free for those whites who controlled the ascending ladder of command posts and the class hierarchies of entrepreneurial advantage. At least a helot or slave or serf merits the right to be fed, but to be a freed serf without a master becomes the worst victim of the economics of scarcity. The Great Depression was an era of artificial scarcity in which the prize of civil rights was the freedom to survive, to starve to death without regard to race, creed, color, or national origin. So the black Cruz, a historian that Jones quotes a lot, says that basically, in not so many words, the Jews didn't have the blacks' interests at heart, because what really mattered to the black was not the freedom to starve to death as a so-called equal, but, you know, real economic empowerment. Says Jones, in spite of the fact the litigation was a strong suit, the NAACP was reluctant to get involved in that Scottsboro Boys case, largely because that organization was reluctant to defend a group of Negroes who had been accused of raping two white women. Interracial sex was the third rail of political and social life in the South, and the NAACP knew that better than most organizations. Walter White, executive secretary of the NAACP, followed the Scottsboro Boys case in the newspapers. If anything, those reports convinced him that, quote, the last thing they wanted was to identify the association with a gang of mass rapists. The Communist Party, however, saw their opportunity and seized it. Charles Dirba, D-I-R-B-A, the assistant secretary of the International Labor Defense and a member of the Communist Party Central Committee, recognized the political value of the trial immediately and sent a telegram to the Central Committee urging them to get involved in the case. And this goes all the way back to Russia. As a result, the Communist Party, through its legal arm, the International Labor Defense, took over the case. The Communist Party rightly saw the Scottsboro Boys trial as an opportunity to recruit members from the Black Belt. This would be the area of the South from roughly Galveston and the East Texas coast all the way over to South Carolina and up into North Carolina, Virginia, even Maryland. That's the Black Belt. That's where the mass of the black population in the United States resided, even with the great movement north, the two great waves of black movement north in the first 50 years around the time of the two world wars. Still, most of the blacks lived in the South. The Communist Party had been trying to turn Negroes into revolutionaries ever since Claude McKay had showed up in Moscow in 1922, and the Fourth Comintern Congress meeting in Moscow discussed America's race problem for the first time. So you had some of the top-level blacks, whether they came from Jamaica or originated in the U.S., they're going to Harlem, and from there they're picking up these Jew radical ideas, and some of them, artists like Claude McKay, are even going over to Moscow, where they're treated as kind of, you know, trophies. And they begin to discuss the prospects for using revolutionized Negroes as radicals in the U.S. And so that first started to happen, and they discussed race over there in 1922. This is now 1931 in Alabama, where they're going to bring something to fruition. Party leaders, for the most part, totally unfamiliar with the situation in the American South, that would be Russian communist leaders, or Jews in Russia. had no idea how to create a program that could capitalize on the unrest there. Since Claude McKay was from Jamaica, he knew a little more about the situation in the South than Radek or Zinoviev did, two Jew communists. But he was certainly black, blacker than W.E.B. Du Bois, who would take another 40 years before he decided to join the Communist Party. And it was as a black man that McKay made a hit in Russia. This is Claude McKay again. He's written about in Libido Dominandi. We haven't gotten to that portion of the book yet. Cruz would later say that McKay was selected as a, quote, special delegate, unquote, representing American Negroes, merely because he was the only Negro in Moscow at the moment. McKay, who eventually contracted syphilis, and remember that Jones's big point is that sexual liberation and political revolution are essentially the same thing. They go hand in hand. So McKay is over in Russia. He's discussing with the Jewish communists how they can use race to revolutionize the American South in the 1920s. McKay contracts syphilis either in Moscow or Berlin and has to travel to Paris for treatment. Was interested in revolution more for the sexual or artistic opportunities it offered, something that was evidently apparent to the official American Communist Party delegation, which demanded that McKay be deported back to the U.S. after they arrived in Moscow. McKay, like millions of ordinary human beings and thousands of writers, went to Russia because he was, quote, stirred by the Russian thunder rolling around the world, you know, in the wake of the Russian Revolution in 1917. But when he got there, Radek wanted to know if he had a plan. McKay had to admit that he didn't have a plan. The simple fact of the matter was that the revolutionaries had been wanting to turn the Negro into a revolutionary and, quote, take the war to Africa, unquote, ever since Toussaint Louverture and John Brown. That would be the Haitian revolutionary in 1798 who drove and killed the whites out in Haiti, took it over for the black slaves, and John Brown, the American abolitionist, around before the Civil War. But no one, least of all American blacks, knew how to do it, how to take the war to Africa. As a result, the Negro lost his place at the head of his own revolution, and that place was taken by the Jews, says Jones, who, although they were not black, did know a lot about how to start revolutions. Since no one really understood the relation between ethnos and class when it came to the American Negro, the Jews got to impose their position on the situation because they were in charge of the revolutionary movement. 40-some years after the fact, Harold Cruz rails against this decision as, in effect, destroying whatever political power the Negro was about to gain under Marcus Garvey. That's the black nationalist whose cause we discussed in earlier Radio Astinas. He wanted blacks to go back to Africa. The Jews wanted them blacks to stay in America so they could be used by the Jew revolutionaries to destroy the country, exactly as we see today. What McKay should have told Radek, according to Cruz, is, quote, that the American Party was not a party of the American workers as such, but an organization in which left-wing political power was exercised and predicated on national groups, particularly the Jewish group that later came to dominate left-wing affairs in a degree all out of proportion to its number. Jews were also able to play a three-way game inside the communist left-wing. Left-wing Jews were able to drop their Jewishness and pick it up whenever it suited them. They were able to function as American whites without prejudice, especially in the cultural fields. They were able, as Jews, to wield power through the Jewish Federation. Later, they were able to function as a pro-Zionist nationalist within the left. So, Jews yet again find another way in which to mask themselves and their true interest. They're pretending to be communist, interested in the working class taking over and the race-free rise of the proletariat to crush the evil capitalist, but actually they're pursuing specifically Jewish interests. They're playing both sides. They're both the capitalist and the communist. The communists who took power in the Russian Revolution were actually Jews, and they were mostly Jews out of New York, and they were Jews funded by other Jews in New York, Jacob Schiff, Warburg, and the like, to the tune of at least $20 million. That's what made Lenin successful and brought about the communist revolution in Russia. Now they want to bring the same thing to America, and they're willing to do whatever they have to do to bring that about. And the circumstances are such that there's a legacy population of slaves, or descendants of slaves, and how do they use these, you know, at that point, 12 or 15 million people, today 35 to 40 million people, how do they use them to advance their agenda of what is good for Jews? Now, Jones says, because McKay was unable to propose a plan of his own to aid Radek on how to Because McKay was unable to propose a plan of his own to Radek, Karl Radek, on how to turn Negroes into revolutionaries, the communist left allowed Jewish leaders who came out of the Jewish Federation to become experts in the Negro problem in America. Just as Jews did yesterday, and as we see in trying to define black nationalism to blacks, they're trying today to define white nationalism to whites and saying that, oh yeah, we're included. They obviously can't claim to be black, but they can claim to be fellow whites. Oh, we're just another white ethnic group. But if you allow them in, if you allow Jews into an institution, over time they will control it because they're more organized. And as Jones says, they're experts in starting revolution. They know how to foment revolution. They know how to look out for their own interests. Other groups are not as organized as the Jews. And the Jews are only out after Jewish interests. Now, unlike both Cruz and McKay, W.A. Domingo, who, like McKay and Garvey, also came from Jamaica, felt that if Negroes wanted to become revolutionaries, it was necessary first to go to America and learn such advanced thought from the Russian Jews. Because, quote, with the exception of the few who work in the garment industry in New York and come in contact with the wholesome radicalism of Russian Jews, the majority of Negro men and women are deprived of the stimulating influences of advanced political thought. So they're saying, look, the mass of niggers is a bunch of morons, sharecroppers down in Alabama and the southern states. They aren't going to come in contact with these Russian Jew radicals up in New York, so we have to let the Jews effectively speak for the blacks and represent the communist party in these matters and teach, and the Jews will radicalize the Negroes because they know how to do it. Nothing made this more apparent than the Scottsboro Boys case. In defending the Scottsboro Boys, the communists reached the point of highest public visibility in their campaign to portray themselves as the defenders of the downtrodden Negro. But the communist cynical exploitation of the Scottsboro case also brought about the unraveling of the very thing they hoped to achieve by exposing the ethnic double standard at the heart of the new version of the Black-Jewish Alliance. Nothing symbolized this double standard better in Cruz's mind than the fact that, quote, as late as the 1930s, a top communist leader in the Harlem Communist Party was Jewish, rather than black. The same verdict could be applied to the ILD's, International Labor Defense's, handling of the Scottsboro Boys trial, which was heavy-handed and ethnocentrically Jewish, and succeeded in alienating the very people, i.e. the jury, that the ILD lawyers needed to win over. So these Jew communists are using the blacks as their tool, and they don't give a damn what actually happens to the Scottsboro Boys. They purely care about the use of the boys as their political tool. This is always what we see when it comes to Jews. Now I'm going to play two songs and take a quick break, and then we'll get right back to our story. I got to take a little break here just for a second. Two songs and we're back.
You got? All right.
One, two, ready.
Come up the bird, you land it.
call I didn't hear, the signs I didn't heed, the roads I couldn't take, the map that I just wouldn't read. It's a big old world, but I found my way, and the hell and the hurt led me straight to this. It's to the train. I've been a clown, I've been a fool, and I pushed on every chance. I searched far and wide, trying to crawl out of God's hand. But there were stones I didn't throw, and hearts I didn't break, and a little hope I held on to with a silver shining thread of faith. It's a big old world, but I found train I'm in. Here's to this place I found, love I know, the earth and the sky that I call home. And here's to the things I believe, bigger than me, and the moments I find myself right where I'm supposed to be. It's a big old world, but I found my way, and the hell led me straight to this. Yeah. It's a big old world, but I found my way. And the hell and the hurt led me straight to this. And here's to the trains I missed.
Okay, we're back, and we'll continue with the Scottsboro Boys. Get my sound levels right here. Let's see. Okay, I think that should be about correct. And so what we have here is we have these blacks who are accused of raping these two white women, and the Jew communists, including Jew communists in Russia, as well as the Jews who are running the NAACP, are trying to figure how they can best turn this to their Jewish advantage. In this case, in 1931 in Alabama. Okay, so getting back to Jones. Jones says, and what we're going to do is finish with this article today, so we'll probably go about another hour, and then that will be it for today, and then we'll be back on Tuesday. And that will do it for today. But yeah, we got a good ways to go here. Very interesting stuff, and this is history again. You're not going to learn anything about this in public school, other than you're going to hear that these more innocent whites who are a real world parallel to A Time to Kill, in which whites rape blacks, or what's the one with Atticus Finch, To Kill a Mockingbird, in which blacks are falsely accused of rape. So the entire intention of the Jews is to suppress the actual facts of interracial crime under the liberated or revolutionary system they've set up, yesterday called communism in Russia, today called multiculturalism in the U.S., to hide the real facts and present only to your kids and to you the false facts, which are, you know, oh, whites are accusing blacks rather than blacks are actually committing the crimes. And that's why you hear lots more about the Scottsboro Boys or, you know, Emmett Till than you're ever going to hear about Shannon Christian. They have to suppress knowledge of what happened to her, gang raped, gang tortured, gang murdered by niggers. They have to suppress that because it shows their system for what it is, a Jewish tyranny over whites who created America and are the only ones who deserve to be called Americans. Now, okay, so the International Labor Defense and the NAACP, the jurisdictional squabbles between the NAACP and the ILD, the International Labor Defense, over who was going to represent the Scottsboro Boys only exacerbated the situation in the eyes of Alabamians who were reduced to calling down a pox on both houses because, you know, they see them as just a bunch of New York Jews. The feud between the NAACP and the ILD did little to change the minds of Southern observers in this regard. Before long, a consensus emerged in the South. Two groups of New York Jews were using the Scottsboro Boys as a way of gaining market share among the Negroes of the Black Belt. Both the ILD and the NAACP were seen as Yankees meddling in the affairs of the South. The NAACP/ILD squabble prompted one commentator to opine that only the liberal white people of the South should handle the case. Since the NAACP and the ILD seemed engaged in a joint battle to secure the exploiting possibilities of the case rather than to defend the boys themselves. So that's exactly correct. They're going to use them as political tools. They don't care about what actually happens to them. In fact, they might better serve the Jews' cause as martyrs. The Birmingham Age Herald was even stronger in its condemnation of both groups. Quote, "It is now clear that these darkies do not mean a tinker's dam to the organizations which supposedly have been moving heaven and earth on their behalf." Imagine a paper writing something about that today. It's back then they still had a few more independent papers who actually did represent the voice of the community, unlike today when they're all owned by a handful of chains and they all speak only the Jewish agenda and the Jewish party line is all that's pushed by their bureaucrats who are called their writers. The entire episode was a quote, quoting the Birmingham Age-Herald, a nauseating struggle between the communist group and the Negro society, not so much that justice may be done as that selfish interests may be advanced through the capitalization of the episode, unquote. By the time the Scottsboro Boys went on trial, the Communist Party and its front groups like the ILD had superseded the NAACP as the voice of the downtrodden Negro. In order to avert a possible lynching, the first trial began 12 days after the boys' arrest. The defense attorneys assigned by the court were Milo Moody, a doddering senile septuagenarian who hadn't tried a case in years, and Stephen R. Roddy, a Chattanooga real estate attorney who was, quote, so stewed on the first day of the trial that, quote, he could hardly walk straight. The unspoken principle which provided the deep grammar for the trial had already been articulated in The Klansman. That's a novel that I believe was the basis of the birth of the Griffith film, The Birth of the Country. So the deep grammar of the trial had been articulated in The Klansman. Whenever a white woman accuses a Negro of rape, the Negro is guilty. Since race had attained a metaphysical status in the South, it challenged morality as the criterion of human action. So again, this is Jones the Catholic saying that the South was placing a race ahead of morality. This meant that white women, because of their racial endowment, were ipso facto virtuous. Somehow that didn't seem convincing, completely plausible, and so it was left to the successors of Thomas Dixon, the novelist who wrote The Klansman, to come up with a proper formulation of the relationship between race and morals. In their apologia for the Southern point of view, Crenshaw and Miller in Scottsboro, The Firebrand of Communism, that's a book, Scottsboro, the Firebrand of Communism by Crenshaw and Miller, claimed that since the first slave was brought into this country by the New England traders, the white race has insisted that the Negro respect the white woman, regardless of her position in society. And when he violates the person of a white woman, he has committed, quote, the unpardonable sin, unquote, in the eyes of the Southern white. Since sexual activity can be consensual, rape trials often have to deal with the character of the woman leveling the accusation. However, race at this point intervened in the South. However, race at this point intervened in the issue as the South defined it and rendered such inquiry impermissible. The character of those Huntsville girls, Crenshaw and Miller wrote, whatever they might be, is not the concern of the authorities or the courts. According to the racial code of the South, the character of the white woman was subordinate to her race. If she accused a member of an inferior race of rape, her word superseded the word of the man who was accused on racial grounds alone. And I'd like to point out that Jones's magazine has a lot of typos in it, and it is misspelled superseded twice in two different ways. It's kind of irritating. Superseded is S-U-P-E-R-S-E-D-E-D. If she accused, so what he's saying is that white women could accuse niggers of rape, and all that matters was that she was white and the nigger is a member of an inferior race. In 1932, the Winston-Salem, North Carolina Journal noted that in the South it has been traditional that its white womanhood shall be held inviolate by an inferior race, and it mattered not whether the woman was a spotless virgin or a nymph de pave, which is a French term, I don't know what it means, but something like a nymph of the pavement, I guess, like a prostitute. There could be no extenuating circumstances. If a white woman was willing to swear that a Negro either raped or attempted to rape her, we see to it that the Negro is executed, declared Arkansas poet John Good Fletcher. When Victoria Price was allowed to tell her side of the story on the stand during the first trial, the defense attorney's cross-examination was so perfunctory that the issue of her character simply did not arise. Nor did the issue of the physical evidence supporting her claim of whether she had been raped arise, because the doctors who examined Price and Bates were not cross-examined. When the Scottsboro boys themselves took the stand, three of the boys said a gang rape did occur, but six denied it. In the end, no closing statement was offered by the defense attorneys. Not surprisingly, the jury returned a verdict of guilty, which elicited a loud roar of approval from the crowd outside the courthouse that was clearly heard by the second jury, which was still deliberating on the fate of the rest of the defendants. In the end, eight of the nine Scottsboro boys had been sentenced to death. The judge had to declare a mistrial in the case of the ninth defendant, a 12-year-old boy by the name of Roy Wright, because 11 of the jurors held out for death despite the request of the prosecutor for life sentence in light of his tender age. Largely because communist ideologues in Moscow concluded that American Negroes constituted an oppressed nation dwelling within the heart of the Deep South, the Scottsboro trial stirred up all of the old fears which had been circulating through the South since the time of the Toussaint L'Ouverture Rebellion in 1798, and that's the Haitian Revolution, and they don't want that to happen in the South, and it could happen because you've got a situation in which the number of blacks is a lot larger in relation to the number of whites than in, say, the North. The architect of this resolution was Otto Kusinen, a Finnish-born theoretician of Stalin who had never met more than a handful of Negroes in his entire life. Privately, many of the American delegates regarded the program as so much nonsense. The new 1928 Communist Party line, self-determination of the Negroes in the Black Belt, effectively cut the Negroes of the South off from their brothers in the North, many of whom had just left the South and aligned with them because of the a priori application of class theory with antagonistic Southern whites who were seen as workers. So they're saying the Northern blacks and white workers are this part of the same class, but in the South they're a different class, and they require racial self-determination. This is what the communists in 1928 at their conclave think is going to best advance their Communist Party agenda. Since both the poor whites and poor blacks were workers, there was supposed to be a natural affinity between them that overruled any racial antagonism. This was the logic of the revolutionary struggle in the South as articulated by Jews and Finns in Moscow, for whom the Deep South meant Odessa. It had the sort of Russian-Jewish a priori nature that infuriated Harold Cruz, the black historian, who felt that, quote, By 1929, an unyielding, narrow-minded rigidity permeated the party's thought on all questions. The West Indian American Negro Brain Trust could not utter a single theoretical idea about themselves unless they first invoked the precedent of the Moscow Line, so that everybody would know in advance they had not the slightest intention of disagreeing with it. So a lot of these blacks are taking their direction either from Jews in the U.S. or from Jewish communists or Finnish theoreticians over in Eastern Europe, where the first successful Jewish communist revolution has been carried out in 1917, which is, you know, about 13, 14 years before the Scottsboro Boys trial. And through the later, the 20s, the early 20s, they first bring up race, and they continue to work on their party line through the late 20s, and this case in 1931 and 32 gives them a good test case for seeing how their theories will work. If the tactics of the ILD, the International Labor Defense, in racial matters inspired this sort of animosity in the left-wing Negro, Harold Cruz, 30 years later, it's not difficult to imagine the effect they were having on white Southerners in the aftermath of the first Scottsboro trial. During the summer of 1931, a series of events confirmed the direst predictions of Alabamians who argued that the Scottsboro case was a dangerous vehicle of communist agitation. Toward the end of 1930, a communist by the name of Donald Burke opened an office for the Communist Party USA in Birmingham and began distributing leaflets and organizing meetings in Birmingham's black district because, quote, the Scottsboro case renewed the party's hopes that it could organize a significant number of Negroes in the area, unquote. Burke and three assistants who joined him during the time preceding and following the trial distributed leaflets in Scottsboro, Huntsville, Paint Rock, and other areas of Alabama, calling on white and Negro workers to, quote, smash the Scottsboro lynch verdict, unquote. So the communists are agitating down in Birmingham in Alabama as a result of the Scottsboro trial, and they're thinking, hey, we can use this to inflame the Negroes and radicalize them and win them over to our communist cause. On April 29th, 1931, the ILD and the League of Struggle for Negro Rights called an, quote, All Southern Scottsboro Defense Conference, unquote, to meet on May 24th in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Whatever gains the ILD hoped to get from organizing, quote, the oppressed black peasantry, unquote, were offset by the hostility these efforts aroused on the part of white Southerners who felt that revolution was imminent. Remember, when we went to Knoxville to bring attention to the Kikes and the system they created that allows Shannon Christians to be tortured and murdered without ever making the news known, we were opposed by a bunch of clowns, literal clowns. And these clowns were of this sort of communist organizing school that are set up at different points in the South and have the intention of radicalizing whether the Negroes in one case or the whites in the case of the people that were opposing us. The fact that communists were now openly advocating revolution among the area's Negroes alarmed and disturbed conservative Southerners, unquote. When the Chattanooga Conference failed to mobilize the local Negroes, the ILD, Senate, this is again a communist front group, International Labor Defense. A lot of times when you see something that's labor, it's a communist front. So the ILD holds a conference in Chattanooga, doesn't go particularly well. They sent a number of communist organizers into Tallapoosa County, one of the rural cotton-growing counties in central Alabama, where the majority of the population was black. And I think the two blackest states in the Union are Alabama and Mississippi, where you have pretty close to 50-50, the number of blacks versus whites. So naturally, you see why the communists would want to get a wedge in here and organize the blacks against the whites. They'd have a better base to start from. In early June 1931, four white men and one Negro from Chattanooga moved without announcement into the most predominantly Negro section of the county around Camp Hill. When a Negro tenant farmer informed Sheriff J. Kyle Young that communists were meeting in the Mary Church near Camp Hill, Young approached Ralph Gray to question him about the, quote, radical meetings, unquote, which were reportedly being held to protest the Scottsboro case. So the communists are going into the blackest counties and the blackest states in the country, and they're preaching communist revolution. During the course of their meeting, Gray opened fire on Young and his deputies, setting off a panic that lasted for weeks. By 2 a.m. of the day following the shooting, every white man within 20 miles had armed himself, and a posse which numbered more than 500 men began rounding up suspects in an atmosphere of panic and alarm. Files Crenshaw, or Feels Crenshaw, I guess that's his name. Crenshaw gives the South view of what was happening when he states that, quote, 34 Negroes were arrested in connection with the uprising, unquote. Crenshaw goes on to add that a Negro church and five Negro residences had been burned down in the fall of 1931. So the whites are arming themselves and fighting back against communist Negroes who are being organized by these white interlopers coming down, and these Jew interlopers coming down from Chattanooga, another of their radical holes. Mayor Thomas Russell blamed the arson on, quote, communist sympathizers, unquote. Crenshaw also claimed that another Negro minister in Tallapoosa County received several anonymous threats that his church would be burned down if he continued his crusade against communism. The Alabama Department of the American Legion called the attention of the state to the, quote, horde of communists, unquote, who had descended upon Alabama, spreading a flood of propaganda opposing our form of government and social conditions, our race relationships, and all the bases upon which our society rests, advocating race equality and destruction of law and authority by force and violence. That's the Alabama Department of the American Legion. Before long, the panic created rumors which took on a life of their own. Reading a report announcing Negro Reds reported advancing in the Saturday morning edition of the Birmingham Age Herald, 150 armed men formed a blockade at the highway bridge north of Tallapoosa, only to learn that the two dozen approaching cars belonged to a funeral procession on its way to a country graveyard north of Dadeville. Somewhat embarrassed, the men allowed the procession to go on and gradually began returning to their homes. Superintendent Robert Rusa Moton of Tuskegee sent several carloads of prominent Negroes to the area to prevent Tallapoosa Negroes from, quote, unquote, going red. Moton warned Alabama Negroes, quote, against permitting themselves to be stirred up by outside agitators who come with plausible arguments and fair promises, creating suspicion and ill will between the races. So imagine back then, perhaps what's most remarkable about that is the papers actually warning the whites of their community, leading to 150 armed men forming a blockade. Whereas today, the paper would be downplaying it or advocating in favor of the blacks, covering up the crimes that blacks do instead of stirring false fears about what they were up to. It's what they do today. On August 4th, the fears that turned out to be false, they weren't intended to be false the way that today they do intend to cover up the actual crime, race crime situation in order to quell white resistance. Now, let's see. On August 4th, Alabamians' fears that the Reds were stirring up the Negroes to insurrection seemed confirmed when three young women were raped by a Negro who harangued them about how white people had mistreated his people. So already, the lie spread by the Jews and the putting the chip in the shoulder has its natural result in niggers making violent acts against whites, which is just what the Jew intends. And just what they cover up in their media, even as they celebrate it privately. One local newspaper felt the rape could be traced to the influence of communist agitators bent on stirring up insurrection. In retelling the rape story, Crenshaw praised, quote, Negro organizations in Birmingham, which offered every assistance at their command in the search for the slayer, and expressed the belief that the murderer was no product of Alabama, and possibly came to the state for the purpose of making trouble in the furtherance of propaganda to which both races in the South were opposed. So you've kind of got your good Negroes or your humble cotton-picking tenant farmer, sharecropper Negroes who believe in capitalism and believe in Christianity, and into this milieu are moving the communist organizers from the North, pushing Jewish party line, whether they themselves are Jews or not, and trying to inflame and excite these Negroes against the whites, and using the Scottsboro trial as the pretext for it. Crenshaw, who's the Southern pro-South historian, I gather, also praised the Interracial Commission in Alabama for issuing a warning that communist agitators, by pretending friendship for the Negro, were using him simply as a means to an end. After claiming that the suspect in the crime had come from Chicago, Crenshaw cautioned against condemning a whole race for the actions of a few of its criminal members, because the real issue was outside communist agitation. Crenshaw says, quote, "The murder of the two girls and the uprising in Tallapoosa County could both be traced to the influx of the Reds, beginning with their defense of the Scottsboro Negro rapists. As long as these black fiends remained alive, they would be, quote, used by the Reds to incite our colored people to riot, rape, and kill," unquote. Crenshaw recounts other rapes and claims they resulted from ILD agitation. That is, ILD, communist agitation, is responsible for other rapes, says Crenshaw. When three Negroes were arrested in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, on charges of attacking and slaying Vodine Matos, a 20-year-old white girl in an isolated community near the Bibb County line, the ILD got involved in the case, quote, "to inflame the public mind," unquote, and as a result, the suspects, Dan Pippin Jr., A.T. Hardin, and Elmore Clark, were lynched. In his report on the incident, Tuscaloosa Sheriff R.L. Shamblin claimed that feeling aroused by the ILD lawyers was, quote, "directly responsible for this violence," unquote. For the left, the Scottsboro Boys trial had become a symbol of racial injustice. For the white South, it became a symbol of communist subversion. The first victims of the communist agitation were the Scottsboro Boys themselves. One Harvard graduate from northern Alabama claimed, quote, "I might have been for acquitting them at the first trial, but now, after all the stink's been raised, we've got to hang them," unquote. The main group responsible for the stink was the communist, who had been talking about, quote, "how white folks oppressed the niggers and about communism," unquote. The struggle to turn the Negro into a revolutionary would continue throughout the 1930s. Garvey, who had expelled the communists from the UNIA, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, we discussed in, I think, 22, could have posed an alternative to communist agitation, but Garvey was in exile in England at the time. The Jews broke down the UNIA because it wanted to take blacks back to Africa and thereby remove the problem of the irreconcilability of the races by physically separating them with an ocean. Cruz claims that, quote, "Garvey's plans ended in fiasco because of opposition in Africa, his own egoism, and financial incompetence," but he fails to add that the machinations of the NAACP played the major role in Garvey's demise. Again, this is not a white nationalist saying this. This is a traditional Catholic who is saying that Jewish machinations caused the death of Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement. The Jews deliberately undermined black nationalists and black Zionists who wanted blacks to go back to the motherland that they had been taken from by Jewish slave ship owners. And so we have non-white nationalist confirmation of what we say, which is that Jews care only about what is good for Jews, and they will despoil, they will destroy any settled pattern of relations meant to keep hostility between the races at a minimum where they're forced to coexist. Hence, they're undermining Jim Crow, they're undermining any kind of law that protects whites from blacks, and they're downplaying the results after they've achieved the success of flipping legal privilege from whites to blacks. They downplay the results of that, of both the incitement. Blacks are incited by Jews, and then they're given legal freedom to roam in white communities, and the results of that are rape, robbery, murder, and the Jews downplay these in their media because it's good for them to have blacks threatening the white population that might otherwise see the Jews as a distinct and alien minority. The vacuum which Garvey's expulsion left behind could not have been filled by the NAACP. Again, that's the Jewish false front organization representing blacks, ostensibly, whereas Garvey's really did represent blacks, and for that reason it had to be destroyed by the Jews behind the NAACP. So Jones is saying the vacuum left by Garvey was filled by the openly revolutionary Communist Party, which began its campaign to turn the Negroes in the Black Belt of the South into the vanguard of the revolution in the United States with the trial of the Scottsboro Boys as kind of the news peg. The Scottsboro Boys trial, like the Leo Frank trial almost 20 years before, was a source of pride to liberal Southerners who claimed that the South no longer needed Judge Lynch. That was their term for lynching. Alabamians were upset when they learned that, quote, outsiders, unquote, did not share their views about the triumph of the legal system in the South over lynching. So just as in the Frank trial, we see that the South, when it refrains from lynching and goes through a regular trial, reaches a conclusion. If it reaches the conclusion the North and the Jews don't like, it gets denounced as a bunch of ignorant hick racists and inbred hillbillies. And they don't like that. They're saying, look, we didn't lynch him. We refrained from that. We conducted a fair trial, and this is what was found. You should accept that. More characteristic of how those outside Alabama viewed the trial was the disgusted outcry of a New York college student. What kind of mindless savage are you? He asked Judge A.E. Hawkins. Is condemning 8 teenagers to death on the testimony of 2 white prostitutes your idea of enlightened Alabama justice? The South, above all else, says Jones, feared the return of Reconstruction, a time when unscrupulous outsiders used the bayonets of Negro troops in an effort to put the black foot upon the white neck. Reconstruction was synonymous with outside influence, which invariably led to a return to lynch law, because it was the only way the South could protect itself. The Chattanooga Daily Times claimed that the outside interference of Northern organizations into the South's legal processes can serve no purpose other than to make it more difficult to stop lynchings in the South. Oftentimes, it was only the assurance of a speedy trial that quieted the mob bent on lynching the suspect. When the communist propaganda surrounding the Scottsboro trial ridiculed the courts of Alabama as engaging in officially sanctioned lynching, it undermined the very thing the South was trying to uphold, namely the rule of law as an alternative to lynching. Gradually, fear of communism became the real issue in the case, and the 9 defendants' guilt or innocence receded into the background. Judge Hawkins told Roddy that, quote, the communists are more of an issue than are the facts of the case. The issue of communism had made it impossible for the governor to pardon the 8 young men. The Reverend Asbury Smith, pastor of one of the largest Negro churches in Baltimore, claimed, quote, that the rapid swing of Negroes away from their traditionally conservative position was due almost entirely to the communist campaign for the Scottsboro Boys, unquote. So a Baltimore pastor saying, look, the communists went down there and successfully used this trial as a means to communize, inflame, or radicalize the otherwise conservative Christian niggers of Alabama. Alabamians were unanimous in their firm conviction that the communists had seized the Scottsboro case for purely mercenary motives. The Alabama Interracial Commission charged that there was, quote, brilliant leadership, sleepless energy, and apparently unlimited money behind the malevolent communist activity. And if that phrase ought to bring to mind what Winston Churchill said about the Jews, and he said, used a very similar set of 3 phrases to describe the communists behind the Russian Revolution, and their he pointed to their malevolence, their immaturity, and their hostility. And so it is here. We see the same thing described by a different group of people in the Alabama Interracial Commission, who are basically saying that the brilliant leadership, sleepless energy, and apparently unlimited money were behind the malevolent communist activity to inflame the blacks on the basis of the Scottsboro Boys trial. These apostles of revolution pretended friendship for Negroes, but this was only a means to reach their selfish ends. Without a doubt, declared the commission, race hatred, race discord, murder, rape, and lynchings were the communist immediate object. They were trying to create a revolution. Undeterred by the reaction they were creating, the communists pressed on with their efforts to revolutionize the Black Belt Negroes. In order to better coordinate their activities, the ILD moved its offices into the Birmingham headquarters of the Communist Party, so giving up even the pretense of being a front. Aware of this and other motives by the moves by the communists, the Klan began to revive and began to distribute handbills and placards announcing how, quote, the Klan rides again to stamp out communism and warning Negroes to be wary of Bolsheviks. During late 1931 and early 1932, When it was reviewing the first Scottsboro trials, the Alabama Supreme Court was inundated by a flood of intemperately worded invective that had the effect of hardening them in their resolve to resist outside agitation. These messages, said Chief Justice John C. Anderson in January of 1932, are highly improper, inflammatory, and revolutionary in their nature, and they were sent with evident intent to bulldoze this court. When Joseph Brodsky quoted from Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes' dissent in the Leo Frank case, Supreme Court Justice Knight responded by saying, "I have the deepest reverence for Justice Holmes, but I wonder if he had lived a little closer to the South, whether he would have written those decisions. Had he known how jealously we have striven to uphold our rights and protect our womanhood." So, Oliver Wendell Holmes is one of the minority that favored a new trial for Leo Frank, whereas the rest upheld what the Georgia State Supreme Court had found, that he was guilty. Once again, the communists overplayed their hand and brought about the exact opposite of what they said they wanted. On March 24th, by a margin of 6-1, the Alabama Supreme Court upheld the conviction of all but one of the defendants. Chief Justice Anderson told NAACP's Walter White that communist propaganda had, quote, possibly injured the defendants, unquote. Like the Frank case, the Scottsboro case, Boys case, went to the United States Supreme Court. But this time the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the defense, overturning the verdict of the Alabama Supreme Court. The New York Times hailed Powell versus Alabama as a landmark in American jurisprudence, so the Jew paper in New York gets what it wants in the Scottsboro Boys case, as opposed to in the Leo Frank case back in 1915. The Supreme Court decision, however, never allayed, quote, the general suspicion that the ILD was perfectly willing to sacrifice the Scottsboro Boys for whatever were deemed to be the party's best interests. Energized by the Supreme Court decision, the communists redoubled their efforts in the Black Belt, and as a result, there was a new outbreak of racial violence in Tallapoosa County, when word spread through Tuscaloosa that, quote, the communists had come to town, quote, to defend three Negroes charged with raping and killing a 21-year-old white woman. An angry mob formed near the courthouse, threatening to lynch the ILD lawyers, who needed the National Guard carrying rifles with fixed bayonets to get them out of town alive, in a harbinger of what happened after the Brown versus Board of Education, when it took National Guardsmen with rifles to get the niggers mixed into white schools in order to destroy them and reduce whites' chance of getting an actual education, as their teachers were forced to cope with monkeys. And so, the Scottsboro Boys are found guilty, and the verdict is upheld by the state Supreme Court. The Jew commies take the case to the United States Supreme Court, which overturns the verdict of the state court. And then the communists redouble their effort, and their efforts lead to whites being raped and murdered, white women being raped and murdered. And at this time, point in time, whites still have enough gumption, enough honor, and haven't been brainwashed enough that they rise up in angry mobs to defend themselves, and they still have enough media under their control, media that are sympathetic to them, or at least treat them fairly, that they get some defense in the public sheets as well as in the streets. Appalled by the prospect of another Scottsboro Boys-style trial in Tuscaloosa, that is, of the niggs who raped the white woman, the sheriff's deputies executed the three men in front of a firing squad in an isolated section of the county. The ILD lawyers, in other words, brought about the lynching that they claimed they were there to prevent. So, three niggers were charged with raping and killing a white woman in the wake of a communist inflammation, in the wake of the Scottsboro trial, and the outside communists come in and try to make another big deal of it, and so this leads to them simply being executed by a firing squad without messing around, which is the way it should be. The local news blamed the disturbances on the international labor defense, preaching their poison communistic propaganda among our contented Negro population. The local press also held the ILD responsible for the suspect's death. The Tuscaloosa News claimed that, quote, the maggoty beaks of the belled buzzards of the international labor defense are stained with the blood of the three Negroes, unquote. As Episcopal Bishop William G. McDowell observed, the ILD's decision to defend accused Negro rapist was widely construed as an assault on the South's entire social structure, which is exactly what it was. Apparently, the war is on, unquote. And that's exactly it. The Jews are trying to overthrow the entire social structure of the South because they don't like it, because it doesn't meet with their agenda, because they want white populations left open to Negro predation. And that's exactly what has to be reversed. Whites have to regain control of their own communities, and that comes by taking the power away from the Jews, who run the public institutions, who direct our government through their money, and who poison our minds through their media, which they almost uniformly control. That's the important thing to understand. Out of all of this, what we're reading about is a historical example at a time when Jews had far less power than they do today, although they still had a lot of power. They have, you know, 300 times as much power today. And if we allow them to, they will literally genocide us out of existence through race mixing and claims that we don't exist. And if we're proud of our type and our kind and we want it to continue, we're just useless haters who ought to be thrown in jail and despised by people, all for defending ourselves and our way of living. Crenshaw claims that in his Norris versus Alabama decision, that this was an assault on the entire Southern social structure. Actually, it was an assault on the entire white race, but the U.S. Supreme Court deliberately revolutionized the jury system of the South. In doing this, they paved the way for the communists, who intended to finish off the job with a violent revolution. Crenshaw cited the testimony of Borden Burr, a Birmingham attorney and former president of the Alabama Bar Association, who told an Alabama Senate committee on May 16th that, quote, the Communist Party and its affiliates have between 3,000 and 4,000 members in Alabama, and I have undisputed evidence showing they advocate overthrow of our good state and national governments by force, unquote. The Communists boast, Burr told the committee, that they have had greater success in Alabama in the last few years than in any other state. And among the evidence I have are documents proposing that Negroes rise up and establish their own government in Black Belt counties where they are in the majority. So, blacks, Jews are big for majority rights where they or their tools are the majority. But where whites are the majority, you never hear anything about majority rights. You only hear about minority rights. What you hear where whites are the majority is that whites are the past and the future is multiculturalism, as we heard in the Meyerson article earlier today. Right? Meyerson, oh, whites are the past. They represent the old America. They have to get out of the way of the new, wonderful, multicultural America. So even though whites are the majority, they have no rights when Jews want to destroy them. Jews talk about minority rights where they're the minority, and they talk about majority rights where they are their tools and the majority. So again, as always, we see the double standard, reconciled only by the fact that both standards are good for Jews and they're bad for you. Good for the Jew equals bad for you. Convinced that they could now win the case, the ILD selected two attorneys to defend the Scottsboro boys, Samuel Leibowitz, who was not a communist, and Joseph Brodsky, who was. Both of them were Jews. Less important than their politics in the minds of Alabamians was the fact that both men were Jews from New York City. By now, the concepts of communist and New York Jew had become interchangeable in the minds of the average Alabamian, which is to say, the type of person most likely to be chosen to serve on the jury. The fact that one of them was an agent of the ILD, the Communist Front, and the fact that the ILD had total control over the strategy both inside and outside the courtroom only confirmed the idea of outside interference in the minds of the men on the jury, a fact that the prosecutor would exploit. It wasn't just Southern racists who felt that the lawyers were dangling from strings that reached back to New York City. Clarence Darrow felt the same way and said so publicly when he withdrew from the case. Now, this is probably the most famous attorney in America in the first half of the 20th century, and the one involved in the Scopes trial and the teaching of evolution that Mencken wrote about, and then a movie was made about. Clarence Darrow said, if the cases were to be won, Darrow opined, they would have to be won in Alabama, not in Russia or in New York. On January 4th, the NAACP, National Board of Directors, announced the association had decided to withdraw formally from the case. So, the black-faced Jew organization withdraws, and the communist, which is also a Jewish organization, takes over. On March 13, 1933, Samuel Leibowitz arrived in Birmingham and officially assumed command of the case. Patterson and the ILD had chosen Leibowitz because of his reputation as the second Clarence Darrow. So this Jew lawyer from New York is being sent down by this communist front group, and he's going to run the case for the ILD. And his name's Leibowitz, and he has a reputation as sort of a Jewish Clarence Darrow. The resignation of the first Clarence Darrow over the ILD's heavy-handedness in the first trial indicates the honor was misplaced. Darrow was smart enough to know that a Southern jury was not going to be won over by threats and moral posturing. Leibowitz, however, never figured this out. He's going to be condescending and talk down to the Jews. We're going to take one more little break, and then we'll be right back, and we'll finish up the story. Again, we'll play two songs here.
Jealousy is a friend. Yeah, I know he's been a good friend of mine. But lately something's changed, it ain't hard to define. Jesse's got himself a girl and I wanna make her mine. And she's watching him with those eyes. And she's loving with that body, I just know it. And he's holding her. The charade, that doesn't seem to be a reason to change. You know, I feel so dirty when they start talking cute. I wanna tell her that I love her, but the point is probably moot. Cause she's watching him with those eyes, and she's loving him with that body, I just know it. And he's holding her in his arms late at night.
Yeah!
All right, and we're back. Let's see. Now, what we've been talking about is the trials of the Scottsboro Boys, and we finished the first trial, the reaction, and the way the communists have tried to use it. And let me check my sound volumes here. Raise it up a little bit, so trying to get it a little bit louder maybe than it's been in other ones, without interfering with recording quality. Now, okay, I think that'll be about right. All right, and so you've got the ILD, Communist Front, and they're sending in this famous Jew lawyer from New York, who is not a communist, but he's still a New York Jew, and it's all the same to the Southerners, named Leibowitz. And he never figures out that Alabamans don't like to be condescended to any more than any other people. Says Jones, the second trial of Haywood Patterson, who's one of these niggers, began on March 30th, 1933 in Decatur, 50 miles west of Scottsboro, in the courtroom of Judge James Horton. Leibowitz, and this is in the wake, of course, of the Supreme Court decision overturning the initial conviction, Leibowitz moved to quash the indictments on the grounds that Negroes had been systematically excluded from the jury rolls, but his motion was rejected, and the trial proceeded to cover the same ground it covered in the first trial. The difference between the first and second trial lay primarily in the fact that the defendants now had lawyers that would subject the state's witnesses to real cross-examination. A little after 9 a.m. on April the 3rd, Victoria Price was called to stand and recounted her side of the story for what was now the fifth time under oath. For the first time, however, Price was subjected to grueling questioning, which called her character into question. Again, this is Victoria Price. Price and Bates are the two white women involved. Leibowitz introduced documents from the city courts of Huntsville, Alabama, showing that Price had been found guilty of fornication and adultery on January 26, 1931. If Leibowitz expected Price to crack under the strain, he was mistaken, for, according to one woman in the courtroom, Price was not only tough, she was terrifying in her depravity, and brazened out the defense attorney's accusations. Leibowitz's cross-examination was merciless. His questions suggested his answers. There was no Callie Brochi's boarding house in Chattanooga, as Price claimed. She was an adulterer who had consorted with Jack Tiller in the Huntsville freight yards 2 days before the alleged rape, and it was his semen, or that of Orville Gilly, that was found in her vagina. She was a person of low repute, a prostitute. She was neither crying, bleeding, nor seriously bruised after the alleged gang rape, which, you remember, three of the niggers had admitted to. She was fearful of being arrested for a Mann Act violation, that is, crossing state lines for immoral purposes, when she met the posse in Paint Rock. So she and Bates made groundless accusations of rape to deflect attention from their own sins. Leibowitz introduced various affidavits which cast doubt on her status as the flower of Southern womanhood, which is how the prosecution tried to portray her. McKinley Pitts of Chattanooga said he had seen Victoria, quote, embracing Negro men in dances in Negro houses, unquote, and heard her talk to other Negro men, quote, in the most foul and vulgar language, and ask colored men the size of his sick privates. Pitts went on to claim that Ruby Bates bragged to him she could, quote, take five Negroes in one night and not hurt her, unquote. So these are, women are being represented as race-mixing whores and prostitutes by the defense, the Jew defending these the accused nigger gang rapists. Oliver Love, who ran a Negro boarding house in Chattanooga, admitted that because he needed the money, he had allowed Victoria Price to use a room in his house as a base of operations for prostitution. Asbury Clay, so Victoria Price says this nigger is using his boarding house as a base as her center for prostitutions, for Victoria Price, that is. Asbury Clay, a friend of Love, said that a white man had approached her at the boarding house about paying for her services, but Price declined, claiming that she was occupied that evening because it was, quote, unquote, Negro night. So these are not real not real great examples of white people here. the filthy affidavits, quote unquote, which called the character of Price and Bates into question, elicited charges of bribery and witness tampering. The Sentinel claimed that the affidavits had been gathered by, quote, one Chamlee, C-H-A-M-L-E-E, a white lawyer in Chattanooga employed by the Communist Party. The Sentinel could not imagine that such a filthy attack upon two white girls and supplied by Negroes of the lowest class would be given credence by anyone, especially since the Negroes who testified said that, quote, Chamlee had paid them 50 cents for placing their marks on the affidavits. In the end, the affidavits only increased the anger against the defense attorneys. The character issue had already flared up in May of 1931 when the ACLU, another Jewish organization, not begun by them but taken over by them, published an interview which Miss Hollis Ransdell of Louisville, Kentucky, had conducted with Victoria Price. During the course of the interview, Price described the rape, quote, with zest slipping in many vivid and earthy phrases, which the local press had described as unprintable or unspeakable. Miss Ransdell felt that both Price and Bates routinely had sexual intercourse with both whites and Negroes, a fact which called their claim that they had been raped into question. When Ransdell met with Deputy Sheriff Walter Sanders in Huntsville, Sanders claimed that Price hadn't been arrested because she was a, quote, quiet prostitute, unquote. Quiet or well known, Price had the reputation of being a prostitute among those who knew her in Huntsville, and this cast doubt upon her testimony that she had been, quote, a virtuous woman, unquote, up until the time of the rape. Before long, doubts about whether the rape had actually occurred began cropping up among the prosecution's witnesses. During the course of the trial, Dr. Marvin Lynch, one of the gynecologists who examined the women, took Judge Horton aside and, in an impromptu conference held in the court's men's room, told him that he did not believe the girls had been raped. Horton was stunned by the revelation and asked Lynch to testify under oath, but Lynch declined, claiming that it would destroy the practice he was in the process of trying to found. 34 years later, Lynch denied making any statements to Horton, but it was clear that doubts were insinuating themselves into the mind of the judge and others. Leibowitz was able to cast doubt on Victoria Price's moral character, but eventually the strategy would backfire for reasons we have already discussed. Price was seen as a symbol of white Southern womanhood because of her race and not because of her morals, which, as Fields Crenshaw had claimed, were seen as irrelevant. Leibowitz, who was, quote, not accustomed to addressing Southern juries, unquote, failed to take into account, quote, old Southern chivalry, unquote, and the corporate sense of the South, which invariably closed ranks when it felt itself under attack by outsiders. Instead of casting doubt on the truth of her testimony, Leibowitz, in the words of the Sylacauga News, made the average man in the jury box feel like reaching for his gun while his blood boils to the ninth degree. Instead of capitalizing on Judge Horton's doubts, Leibowitz's courtroom manner continued to antagonize the jury. That is, a Jew can't stop being a Jew even when it's not in his own direct interest. He could have just said, look, you know, there's pretty solid evidence here. Regardless of how much you hate me, you hate communists, you hate Jews, you hate people from New York City, there's pretty good evidence here that this woman really is a prostitute, and there's good reason to believe she may be lying about this. Instead of playing it like that, he has to be obnoxious and Jewy about it and further antagonize the jury. And so a Jew keeps on being a Jew. Subsequent statements made safely within the confines of New York City would confirm Alabamian suspicions that Leibowitz felt that he was dealing with a subhuman species of cretin when he addressed Southern whites. When Leibowitz insisted that Attorney General Knight call his client Mr. Sanford on the stand, he antagonized the spectators who saw no slight in Knight's actions. When Leibowitz wondered why there were no Negroes on the jury rolls, the jury felt that he was engaged in an attack on the jury system. The anger quickly spread to the court outside the courthouse, which was threatening to take the law into its own hands. That threat prompted Judge Horton to remind the court that all were equal under the law and that, like St. Paul, we know neither native nor alien, we know neither Jew nor Gentile, we know neither black nor white. So all of you who don't grasp that there's a fundamental problem with Christianity in relation to white interest, there you go. That phrase will always be used to justify treating those who are not our equals as though they are. Because if Jesus did it, how can we not do it? And yes, there are a thousand ways in which they can point out, well, that's not what he really meant. Well, that's how it reads, and that's what it leads to. It leads to that liberal universalism. Treating the nigger as one of our own, treating the Jew as one of our own, when they are not our own. They are opposed to us and our interests. They damage us. There is no universal morality. The morality is recognizing that other races represent a threat to us and dealing with that threat in the way that they show it should be dealt with. Horton's attempts to insist on the rule of law were undermined by the tactics of the Communist Party, whose organs kept referring to him as, quote, a lyncher in sheep's clothing, all the while ignoring the fact that Brodsky was paying subordinates to suborn witnesses in the case. Again, Jew being a Jew, paying people to bear false witness. Upon cross-examination, Assistant Prosecutor Wade Wright was able to elicit damaging testimony from one witness who admitted under oath that Joseph Brodsky, one of the Jew lawyers involved in this, along with Leibowitz, had paid his room and board for almost a month and had even bought him a new $11 suit he was wearing. Suits were $11 back then, I guess. The prosecution knew that the two main pillars upon which their case rested was the testimony of Victoria Price and Ruby Bates. Now Price had been exposed as a prostitute, and Ruby Bates was nowhere to be found. Bates had indicated that she was having second thoughts about her testimony as early as June 1931, when she approached the defense attorneys with what she claimed was important information. Then on January 5, 1932, she had written a letter in which she claimed that, quote, those Negroes did not touch me. I was Jays, but those white boys Jays me. That means jazz or sex. But I was jazed, but those white boys jazed me. I wish those Negroes are not burnt on account of me. That testimony, however, was called into question when a boxer by the name of Myron Perlman announced that he had been paid by George W. Chamley to, quote, get her, Bates, drunk and have her write a letter to one of her fellows stating that the Negroes did not attack or assault her, unquote. Bates then signed an affidavit in which she claimed, quote, I was so drunk that I did not know what I was doing, unquote, when she wrote the first letter under Perlman's direction. Again, Jews don't have the evidence, the fact, or the law on their side, so they have to go by Jewy means, by dishonest, by deception, by murder, by lying. That's the way Jews make their way in the world. Remember Monica Lewinsky. Lying was what you did. It was how you got through life. That's what she said. An unusual Jew? No, a typical Jew. All justified by Jewish doctrine, which says you may cheat a goyim at any time you can get away with it. As long as it doesn't endanger the broader Jewish community, you're perfectly free to cheat goyim, to rape them, to murder them. There's nothing wrong with it by Jewish doctrine, not religious doctrine. It's not a religion, it's just a doctrine that genetic criminal clan follows and has followed for thousands of years. Because it works. According to the new affidavit, the letter contained, quote, all falsehoods, no truth being in it. Chamley denied the charges, but eventually the Chattanooga Bar Association was unmoved and called for his disbarment for conspiracy and interference with pending criminal proceedings. Before long, it was clear that Chamley was working as an agent of the ILD, again, the Jewish Communist Labor Front. A labor defense, which is a communist front, which was also instrumental, the ILD, even though no one knew it at the time, in Bates's disappearance before the beginning of the second trial. Then, in a move which caused a sensation in the courtroom, the defense and not the prosecution called Ruby Bates to the stand, and Bates waltzed down the center of the aisle of the courtroom, decked out in a brand new outfit of New York clothes. But the jolt which Bates's theatrical arrival gave to the defense's case was soon dissipated when she was subjected to the withering cross-exam of the prosecuting attorneys, who suspected more witness tampering by these New York Jews. When asked about her whereabouts for the past few months, she claimed that she had hitched a ride to New York City, where she had worked for a, quote, Jewish lady, unquote, for several weeks. During her stay in New York, Ruby's conscience began to bother her, and so she sought spiritual solace from Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick, he was a big name at the time, the famous New York pastor of the Rockefeller Church. It was Fosdick, Bates claimed, who urged her to return to Alabama and testify. By the time Bates testified on the stand that she had had sexual intercourse with Lester Carter in Chattanooga the night before her departure, and that no one had raped her on the train, she had already given two contradictory versions of her story. Rather than focus on the inconsistency of her testimony, Attorney General Knight focused on her new set of clothes. "Where'd you get that coat?" "That coat," Knight asked her. "I bought it," Bates replied. "Where did you get the money to buy it?" Knight continued. "Dr. Fosdick of New York." Eventually, Ruby Bates got lost in the maze of her own self-contradictions. Her credibility reached such a low point that at one point the spectators in the courtroom burst out laughing, something which infuriated Leibowitz and, quote, "made it clear that Ruby's testimony was not making a favorable impression on the jury," unquote, which was now coming to the conclusion that the defense had spirited her away to New York City and had bribed her to change her testimony. When Morgan County Solicitor Wade Wright began his summation for the jury, "New York City would play a large role in what he had to say," says Jones. In a statement that would become the most famous line associated with the trial, Wade Wright asked the jurors to, quote, "show them that Alabama justice cannot be bought and sold with Jew money from New York." Very similar to what we saw in the Frank case, in the writings of Tom Watson in the local paper that wasn't bribed or owned by Jews. "Show them that Alabama justice cannot be bought and sold with Jew money from New York," says the prosecutor to the jury. Leibowitz immediately jumped up and demanded a mistrial, but his motion was denied. In the end, Wright was as accurate in reading the mind of the jury as Leibowitz was in misreading it and, intentionally or otherwise, antagonizing the people he needed to persuade. At 10 a.m. on Sunday, April 9th, 1933, the jury entered the courtroom laughing and announced that they had reached a verdict. Judge Horton then read the note in large pencil-written letters which they handed him. "We find the defendant guilty as charged and fix the punishment at death in the electric chair," unquote. Leibowitz was stunned by the verdict and slumped back in his chair, showing that his ignorance of the psychology of Southern juries persisted until the bitter end. In other words, he was like whites who didn't think that the niggers on O.J.'s jury were going to let him off. The defense had played right into the prosecution's hands by doing everything within its power to arouse the Alabamians' ancestral fears that the South was once again under attack by outside agitators. Mary Heaton Vorse claimed that the jury had been convinced that Ruby Bates' clothes had been, quote, "bought with Jew money from New York," unquote, and that Bates had, quote, "been contaminated," quote, "by her trip there." Wade Wright's statement about the Jew money from New York was the most effective single statement by the counsel for the prosecution because, as John Hammond pointed out in The Nation, that's the radical left-wing publication, it registered to perfection the repressed feelings and prejudices of the 12 good men. So exactly this. Even though the white women were not really of good character and might not have been raped, the Jews had so Jewed up the case with their spreading of hatred of Alabama and Alabamians and their bribing and suborning of witnesses that the jury thought it necessary to convict these niggers. The South, once again, as in the Leo Frank case back, remember, in 1915, was reacting to the threat of Yankee meddling, this time as carried out by New York Jews, by closing ranks, and they were willing to do this even if it meant defending two prostitutes as the flower of Southern womanhood and sending eight Negro boys to their deaths in the electric chair. That's how strong whites used to defend their own. Worse today, when Shannon Christian is raped and murdered, they do nothing about it. They sit quietly. They allow the Jew media to cover it up, or even blame them, and laugh about it, and celebrate it. The death of the Scottsboro boys, says Jones, became a certainty once the ILD became involved in the case and began using its agents to bribe witnesses and intimidate both judge and jury. So they're not only bribing witnesses, they were writing the letters to the court threatening it, knowing that they had the Supreme Court on their side. "If there has been no fair trial, outside pressure on Atlanta is chiefly responsible for it." I'm not sure if that's a misprint or what, or that should have been Alabama. "If there has been no fair trial, outside pressure on Alabama is chiefly responsible for it," said the Charleston, South Carolina News and Courier. The Charlotte Observer called the verdict a natural reaction to outside agitation. Which is funny, because that's what I always say. What is anti-Semitism? Is the natural human reaction to Jewish behavior. And the natural Southern reaction was to protect its own, even if they were a couple of prostitutes, because they were white. And prevent and defend its own from Jews coming down from the north and inspiring with communism the Negroes to revolt. Unless this Russianized northern element was defeated, there could be no peace and tranquility in Alabama. Conceivably, a local defense without the triple disadvantage of being radical Jewish and northern could have gained a compromise, such as life imprisonment, but the jury's loyalty to its white caste could only be proven unequivocally by a guilty verdict. And again, here's where we probably differ from Jones. Jones would probably say it's bad. We all follow the same moral law, and blacks should not be found guilty unless they are guilty, and that should override all other considerations, such as communal self-protection. Better to sacrifice some innocent Negroes than all guilty whites. And see, that's the thing. Today, 40,000 white women are raped a year because the whites won't stand up for themselves, and because they won't take power back from the Jews who loosed these niggers into our communities and made them legally privileged over us. Now they're allowed to get away with rapes and murders. Whereas yesterday, one or two of them might have been innocent but was found guilty. Today, thousands and thousands and thousands of them are guilty and are found innocent, or never go to trial even, are allowed to get away with and encouraged to attack whites by a Jew community that celebrates our dispossession, as we saw in the Meyerson article earlier. Hates white America, do the Jews. While calling those who would defend whites the real haters. Whether Haywood Patterson was guilty or innocent was, at most, a peripheral question, says Jones. So, okay, the Jews have lost the first case. They've got it overturned by the Supreme Court. They've gone back and they've lost the second case. They've had Jew lawyers and Jew communist fronts managing the strategy of the case, and in the end, they've lost. And so the Jew Leibowitz goes back to New York City, where he's given a hero's welcome as over 3,000 enthusiastic and cheering supporters, most of them black, jam Pennsylvania Station to greet him, that Pennsylvania Station in New York. Leibowitz reacted to the adulation of the crowds in New York by insulting the entire state of Alabama. When asked by a reporter from the New York Herald Tribune how the jury could convict Patterson, Leibowitz responded by saying that, and this is really something, if you ever saw those creatures, those bigots whose mouths are slits in their faces, whose eyes pop out at you like frogs, whose chins drip tobacco juice, bewhiskered and filthy, you would not ask how they could do it, said the Jew Leibowitz. Leibowitz went on to add that he felt in need of a, quote, moral, mental, and physical bath, unquote, as a result of the 2 weeks he had just spent in Decatur, Alabama. So the Jew lets his true feelings out once he's back safely in the northern environs of New York City. Leibowitz said this, it should be noted, when eight of his clients were still facing charges in Alabama, from whose citizens, quote, whose chins drip tobacco juice, their juries would have to be drawn. So there's why you might want to think twice before hiring a Jew to defend you, because the Jew doesn't give a fuck about you. It's all about him and his people and what's good for them. And he's still got eight of them are still sitting there going to be judged by juries, and he's making this kind of inflammatory statement after having lost the case of Haywood Patterson. When news of his remarks reached the South, Attorney General Knight denounced them as, quote, the wail of a contemptible loser, particularly in the view of the fact that in his address to the jury, he lauded the people of Morgan County and the members of the jury to the skies. So he's a typical Jew. He's speaking out of both sides of his mouth. Knight concluded his remarks by adding that, I, like every other Southerner, resent his despicable slurs. The Southern press agreed with Knight, because it wasn't all in the Jews' hands yet, this being only 1931 rather than today. You'd never find anything not promoting the Jews line appearing in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, for example. The Southern press agreed with Knight. The New York Jew says there is no such thing as a fair trial in Alabama, said the Athens, Alabama Courier. It seems to this paper that this recent recruit from Russia is a poor sort of chap to blight the good name of Alabama, unquote. And the Sylacauga News, I don't know where Sylacauga is, proudly declared, when these German communists hear of the latest echo from their New York foghorn lawyer, they will doubtless learn true blue Americans have not yet grasped the meaning of the order to retreat. Judge Horton concurred, the statement of itself of necessity must make impossible any just and impartial verdict. The accused Negro must be a victim of this statement. His leading attorney would be a millstone around his neck. Again, Jews don't truly care about what's good for the individual blacks, let alone the race. They only care about using the blacks as a tool to achieve their communist anti-white revolution, destroying the culture of the South. We talked about last time, the Newsweek recently ran a cover story saying, "The end of the South. Yay, we have triumphed. We have defeated the South. Celebrate the Jews. We've filled it with Mexicans. We've got all of its white daughters fucking Negroes as best we can encourage through our MTV. We have defeated and ended the South." They're celebrating their genocide. That's what Jews do. All of their holidays are celebrations of their genocide of other people. Purim, for example. Look it up if you're not familiar with it. Jews celebrate their destruction and slaughter of other people and dragging down their altars and turning the people out into the street as they take power over us, away from the others, the dirty, hated goyim, the stupid cattle, the miserable shigets and the unclean shiksas, their word for our boys and our girls, our men and our women. Shigets is the male equivalent of shiksa. Brodsky, the other Jew lawyer involved in this case, defended his colleague Leibowitz by claiming that Leibowitz had never made the statement, but as usual, Brodsky only made matters worse, especially when he put Marxist words in Leibowitz's mouth, claiming that Leibowitz's view is that in Decatur and the South, the white workers are imbued with the idea of white supremacy, and that only in the union of the white and Negro workers warring against the ruling class can they gain their ends. Leibowitz refused to back down from what he had said in the Tribune and extended his attack to include the prosecution in the recently concluded trial in terms that were guaranteed to make a bad situation worse. "As for the rest of the brain pack," said Leibowitz, "the wolves of bigotry who raised the Hitler cry of Jew money from New York because we dared to demand a square deal for a poor unfortunate whose skin was black, I stand pat. They are bigots." So even before Hitler, they're using his name, even before the war. Undeterred by the fact that he had just ruined the cause of the remaining defendants and condemned them to the electric chair, although Jones has Hilter, but I'm assuming that's a misprint, "the wolves of bigotry who raised the Hitler cry of Jew money from New York," and there's another typo in that very same line, so I'm going to assume that what he has as Hilter is really Hitler. So the Jew is saying once again that it's only bigots who oppose his Jewish plan to destroy the South through race mixing. But in 1931, the people of Alabama were not putting up with that Jewish garbage. Undeterred by the fact that he had just ruined the cases of the remaining defendants and condemned them to the electric chair, Leibowitz spent the following Thursday evening at Harlem's Salem Methodist Episcopal Church, addressing a cheering crowd of 4,000 Negroes who hailed him as a new Moses. So he's playing to great acclaim in New York and in the niggers and Jews of New York, while down south the other eight who are still up in the air are not being well served by their Jew lawyer, or the Jew lawyer who defended one of their number. It was the beginning of many Scottsboro Boys rallies. On Friday, May 5th, at a mass rally which served as the kickoff for William Davis's March on Washington, one-time prosecution, one-time defense witness Ruby Bates told the crowd that she had lied because, quote, "I was afraid of the southern white ruling class people," unquote. As some indication of what, quote, "southern white ruling class people," unquote, thought of Ruby, the Huntsville Times referred to Bates as Harlem's darling. If she ever tired of telling her story of oppression at the hands of southern white ruling class people to the fashionable leftists in New York, Ruby could go on to a vaudeville engagement where the emoluments should be more lucrative than working in a cotton mill, riding a boxcar as a hobo, or pursuing her avocation as a lady of leisure. The Huntsville Times portrayed being a martyr to the cause of the Scottsboro Boys as more profitable than plying the trade she once did in Huntsville. In spite of the communist invective aimed at portraying him as a mindless bigot, Judge Horton began to have doubts about the verdict shortly after the second trial ended. "The conclusion," Horton eventually wrote, "becomes clearer and clearer that this woman was not forced into intercourse with all of these Negroes upon that train, but that her condition was clearly due to the intercourse she had had on the nights previous to this time." Horton then set the judgment of the jury aside and ordered a new trial, a move which exposed him to an invective from the other side of the political spectrum. The same judge who had been faulted for being a lyncher in sheep's clothing was now accused of being too lenient and, quote, allowing that Jew lawyer who represented the defendants to say and do what he pleased, unquote. By ordering a new trial, Horton was guilty of, quote, putting wicked thoughts into the minds of lawless Negro men and greatly increasing the danger to the white women of Alabama, unquote. So, the judge may be acting in fairness in the individual case, but he's endangering the broader community, and the whites still thought of themselves as a community at that time, and knew that they were under attack by these Jews and these northern radicals, these communist radicals. By ordering a new trial on June 22, 1933, Horton put an end to his own legal career. He was defeated in the May 1934 primary, but even before that happened, the third trial had been taken out of his hands and transferred to the courtroom of William Washington Callahan, a befreckled septuagenarian who seemed like a Central Casting's idea of what a hanging judge from the South ought to be. Oblivious to the effects of his tirade against the South as a bunch of frog-eyed, tobacco-chewing cretins would have on any possible jury, Leibowitz returned for an encore performance, equally oblivious to how their heavy-handed interference with witnesses had convinced the jury to hand down a guilty verdict. In the second trial, the ILD decided to make the same mistake twice by bribing the trial's other main witness, only this time they were caught red-handed. So, Jews and communists are absolutely incorrigible. They will pursue the same ends almost regardless of what happens to themselves, even if it's against their own interests, which suggests that there's something biological about it. Lying is biologically what the Jew does rather than a behavioral choice. Lying is what they do. It's what they've done for so long. It's what they are. They are liars. And they were denounced as liars and a common enemy of all humanity 2,000 years ago. Now, we're probably going to go another half hour here, I think. Maybe a little less. Because we have a little bit more of the story to go. But, like I said, we'll return on Tuesday and we'll have new stories. But, so anyway, we've had one trial guilty, second trial guilty, and both have been overturned or the decision of the jury has been set aside for various reasons, and now they're going with another trial. And the ILD, the Communist Front, who's operating the defense of these Scottsdale boys, is again bribing witnesses. In June 1934, when Jew Joseph Brodsky heard from J.T. Pearson that Victoria Price, one of the two white women, was willing to change her testimony if the price was right, he contacted a New York attorney by the name of Samuel Schriftman, who was associated with ILD and operated under the name of Daniel Swift. Schriftman / Swift, that is a Jew who's adopting a white or Anglo-Saxon name to cover himself, spent the summer of 1934 working out a deal with Pearson, who in August offered Price, one of the women involved, $500 if she would change her testimony. When Pearson increased the figure to $1,000 in September, Price told Pearson he had a deal. What she didn't tell Pearson is that she had gone to the Huntsville police, who encouraged her to play along with the deal, unquote. On October 1st, Price and Pearson set off by car to Nashville, where they were scheduled to meet with Schriftman and Saul Cohn, another associate of Brodsky, who had arrived at a downtown hotel with a briefcase containing $1,500 in $1 bills. As soon as Pearson and Price passed the Huntsville city limits, their car was pulled over and Pearson was arrested. At the same time, Nashville police arrested the two New York Jews and confiscated the money they had brought with them to buy justice, as Wade Wright, the prosecutor, had warned in the state of Alabama. Shortly after the arrest of Schriftman and Cohn, another lawyer by the name of Frank Shiner arrived from New York City and posted a bond of $2,000 for each man after they were bound over to the Madison County Grand Jury. After gaining their release on bond, Crenshaw and Miller Wright, Schriftman and Cohn, two Jew lawyers, left the state and have never returned. Their bonds were declared forfeited. What followed was an orgy of mutual recrimination in a relationship that was already showing severe strain. In the wake of his diatribe in the Tribune, the communists had attacked Leibowitz for condemning the southern masses indiscriminately as morons, lanternjawed, etc., etc. Leibowitz heard about the arrest shortly after noon on October 1st and was on the phone immediately demanding an explanation from Brodsky, who explained that the ILD had been negotiating with Price for months, for 4 months. Brodsky tried to calm Leibowitz down, but at the end of the day he was pouring his heart out to the NAACP, claiming that the ILD had wrecked his case from the beginning. Leibowitz blamed the Ruby Bates debacle on the ILD, claiming that, quote, he had warned Patterson and Brodsky not to bring Ruby to New York because of the inevitable Southern reaction. Leibowitz's reaction prompted many to wonder whether he was lying or whether he had no control over the case. Many Southerners felt that Leibowitz was guilty of protesting too much. Bishop William G. McDowell claimed that Leibowitz's public denunciation of the ILD was a stage play to save his face when they were caught trying to bribe Victoria Price. So, bribing is ordinary, standard operating procedure for these Jews. They don't give a damn about anything except getting the right verdict, or, if that's their secondary goal, using their clients to advance their own political agenda, and, you know, using any means to achieve that. McDowell felt that Leibowitz knew all along that the ILD practices he denounced, and that he would like to recover his prestige by putting on another show at Decatur, no matter who pays the bills. On October 3rd, Leibowitz announced he was withdrawing from the case unless all the communists are removed from the defense. Remember, Leibowitz is not a communist, he says. One day later, the ILD fired Leibowitz, citing his lack of experience in appeals trials as the reason. On October 8th, the Daily Worker escalated the conflict by claiming that Leibowitz had, quote, joined the Alabama lynch rulers in spreading the lying stories of attempts to bribe Victoria Price and other slanders. So this is the way Jews and communists operate. They follow no rules, and the minute it's necessary, they turn on one another. So what followed, says Jones, was the judicial version of musical chairs, as the NAACP and the ILD, both Jewish front groups, one for the blacks and one other for communists, competed for the privilege of representing the Scottsboro Boys, who in turn played one set of lawyers against the other until no one knew who represented whom. On October 16th, the Washington merry-go-round picked up the story. Northern defenders of the Negro are quietly looking for a good liberal Southern Democrat with an Anglo-Saxon name, like, say, John Grisham, huh? Or his legal equivalent. Well, actually, take that back, no equivalent needed. He is a lawyer. To take over the defense of the seven Negroes in the Scottsboro case. Their defenders, tired of supporting lawyers with communist affiliation or foreign names, have made up their minds to get someone with the standing of John W. Davis. What has brought this decision? Is it the arrest of two defense lawyers for alleged attempted bribery of Victoria Price, a white woman who accuses the seven Negroes? The two lawyers are supposed to be unaffiliated with the Communist Party, which unquestionably has used the Scottsboro case for its own ends. So now they're going to try to put a white, southern, liberal, Anglo-Saxon face on their Jewish scheming. On February 15th, 1935, so again, this is already 4 years into this. It started in 31, and it's already February 1935. The United States Supreme Court heard arguments in the Patterson and Norris cases. 6 weeks later, the court announced in Norris versus Alabama, overturn the convictions of Norris and Patterson. So, again, as it did in the second trial, the United States Supreme Court has overturned the state decision. Leibowitz claimed to be, quote, thrilled beyond words, unquote, by the decision, but when Haywood Patterson's fourth trial began in January 1936 in Judge Callahan's courtroom, Leibowitz took a backseat to a local, less Russianized attorney by the name of Charles Watts. So back for the fourth trial in 1936. This has already gone on 5 years now. In December of 1936, while Patterson's appeal was still pending and the other eight blacks awaited their trials, Thomas Knight met secretly with Samuel Leibowitz in New York to discuss a compromise. Knight told Leibowitz that the cases were draining Alabama financially and politically, and that he himself was sick of it all. He offered to drop the prosecutions of three and give the others no more than 10 years for either rape or assault. Finally, in 1937, in a verdict that satisfied no one, says Jones, four of the defendants were acquitted on the same evidence that had convicted the other four, leaving Alabama, as one wag pointed out, in the anomalous position of providing only 50% protection for the flower of Southern womanhood. So, 6 years later, from 1931 to 1937, this is going on in repeated cases, convictions, and overturnings, till finally they say, look, we'll convict four of them, we'll let four of them go. In what had become a Southern ritual by now, the Scottsboro Boys followed in the footsteps of Ruby Bates and traveled to New York City, where they were met by Thomas Harten, H-A-R-T-E-N, a Negro minister from Brooklyn who offered to become their quote-unquote manager. Just like Mamiya, the cop killer. One of their first stops in New York was the office of Samuel Leibowitz, whom they attempted to shake down for money after they accused him of making millions at their expense. Then 2 weeks later, the four freed Scottsboro boys appeared on stage at the Apollo Theater along with a cast of 50 fascinating females. From 1913 until World War II, the Jews who owned the Apollo Theater, remember, Live from the Apollo, which is a show that the Jews at NBC would put on after Saturday Night Live for some years. I don't know if they still do, but they used to. This is the same Apollo Theater, and this is their cast. It's salacious sexual stuff combined with some political communist Jewish agitation. From 1913 until World War II, says Jones, the Jews who owned the Apollo Theater had used it as a venue to promote sepia thrills to white audiences. Now Sidney S. Cohen, the man who opened the Apollo to black audiences in 1934, could add social commentary to his all-girl review. The Scottsboro Boys, Cohen's handbill opined, had become the symbol of a struggle for enlightenment and human brotherhood, which will go on and on until it is won, unquote. So that's on the handbill that he's putting out to advertise this girl review. Unfortunately, neither enlightenment and human brotherhood nor 50 fascinating females would earn any money for the Scottsboro Boys, who were in debt after their first week of appearances. In 1938, a pardon for all of the Scottsboro Boys left in Alabama seemed all but assured. Governor Bibb Graves was anxious to end the whole Scottsboro episode before he left office and told the Scottsboro Defense Committee head Alan Chalmers that the five would be released after he had his traditional pre-pardon interviews with each in his office. The interviews, however, could hardly have gone any worse. First, Haywood Patterson was found to be carrying a knife when he was searched on his way to the interview. Patterson claimed he always carried a knife for protection, but authorities assumed the worst. Second, a presumably brain-damaged Ozzie Powell refused to answer Graves' questions, saying, "I don't want to say nothing to you." Third, according to Graves' account, Clarence Norris threatened to kill Haywood Patterson, with whom he had been feuding bitterly after his release. So, even with all this press agitation and political willingness to release them, the Scottsboro niggers can't act like humans. They just continue to act like niggers. Finally, none of the Scottsboro boys admitted any knowledge or guilt concerning a rape aboard the Chattanooga to Memphis freight train, a rape that Graves still believed occurred. Consequently, Graves left office without issuing the pardons. In 1948, Haywood Patterson escaped from the work gang he had been assigned to and headed north. So I guess the niggers continued in jail, the four of them who were left there. And 10 years later, Haywood Patterson escaped from the work gang he had been assigned to and headed north. The FBI finally caught him on December 13, 1950, when he entered a bar in Detroit, Michigan, to sell copies of his newly released autobiography. Imagine a nigger writing a book and then trying to sell it as a way to raise money. Unthinkable today. His autobiography was written with or by Earl Conrad with the assistance of the Communist Party. When Michigan's Governor G. Menin Williams refused to sign extradition papers, Alabama authorities announced they would terminate all efforts to have him returned to the state. So again, the North is basically thumbing its nose at the South and saying that its laws amount to nothing. Kind of echoes of the 1830s cases that my ancestor was involved in relating to slaves being property and what could be done with them. And the states that didn't like slavery might refuse to acknowledge the property status of escaped slaves. In criticizing the Jews' attempt to colonize the Negro mind via their control of the Communist Party, Harold Cruz, the black historian, cites Karl Marx's lines in Zur Judenfrage, on the question of the Jews, This is Marx, quote, "What right, therefore, has he to demand of others the abdication of their religion?" Unquote. The line was especially applicable to the communist dealings with the Scottsboro Boys. Sidney Cohen's tawdry attempts at the Apollo Theater to capitalize financially on the Scottsboro Boys paled in comparison to the Communist Party's attempt to turn Haywood Patterson into a model atheist. According to the account he gave in his autobiography, Patterson, quote, began to, and this is somewhat of Jones's hobby horse here, but we're nearing the end. Patterson began to lose confidence in God by the time of the third trial, largely because the more talk I heard about God, the more I kept seeing the freckles on the face of old Judge Callahan. It was the old argument of evil. Three times I was sentenced to die for something I never did. What was the Lord doing about it? Nothing. Unlike God, the ILD lawyers brought Patterson and the other defendants pops and candy and gave them to us boys in the visiting room. Patterson noticed that the lawyers were Jewish, but that was okay with me because, quote, "I work for Jews in Chattanooga," unquote. The Jews told Patterson and the other Scottsboro boys that, quote, "the people were up in arms over our case in New York, and if they had our say-so, they would like to appeal our cause, or like to appeal our case," unquote. Unnamed guards in the prison warned Patterson that the support of New York Jews was the main reason he had been convicted in the first place, and the main reason why he could not get out of jail and appeal. Quote, "You boys would be free if you kept the New York sons of bitches out of the case. You'd be free," Patterson was told. But all that Patterson can conclude is, quote, "I saw how bitter they were about outsiders pressing our case," unquote. Patterson's association with Jewish communists from New York City eventually undermined his faith in Christ, and the autobiography he wrote, with their help, was a calculated attempt to spread atheism among the Black Belt Negroes. The strategy was hardly new. The voodoo priest who collaborated with Toussaint Louverture in Haiti had urged the slaves there to throw away their crucifixes. German Jews like Odile Assing, Odile Assing tried the same thing with more intellectually sophisticated weapons. Her greatest achievement was introducing Frederick Douglass to the writings of Ludwig Feuerbach and turning him into an atheist. By the time that the thinking of Karl Marx began to dominate the revolutionary movement, atheism and revolution were two sides of the same coin. Hayward Patterson's autobiography simply transposed this thought into the language and culture of the Black Belt in the South. Quote, "I read the Bible long after I began to lose confidence in it. I saw many things there. They contradicted themselves. But the Lord never came there. Nothing but his pictures on the walls. I saw guys pray and cry all hours of the night. What they prayed for, they never got. When you are drowning in the death row, the Bible is the straw you grab. Just bang their backsides with a rod in one hand and flog their brains with a Bible in the other and say, 'Now you just mind that white man and do like he say. You get along with him then.'" Christianity, while not antagonistic to ethnos, says Jones, had undermined the notion of a racially based chosen people from the time of St. John's Gospel, when Jesus rejected the Jews' claim that they were the seed of Abraham. The simple fact of the matter is that both blacks and whites in the South, in spite of all the racial antagonism that divided them, did share a culture that was fundamentally Christian and which promoted cooperation on a local level, as during the rape crisis that followed the Scottsboro trials. This localized form of Christianity always threatened to undermine the racial antagonism that communists wanted to turn into revolution and class warfare. Like Ruby Bates, who learned to fear the, quote, "ruling class," unquote, Patterson had learned at the hands of the communist tutors that religion was the opiate of the masses. "Most of all, I saw the..." This is Patterson. "Most of all," who's one of the Scottsboro boys and is on trial and has been tutored by these communists, he says, "most of all, I saw the white man wanted a black man to get down on his knees and be a pray man. They just love that. Then you were their nigger. That alone taught me it couldn't be such a good thing for black folks to be so fetched up in all that Bible stuff." When his mother died in 1937, Patterson decided that he had had enough religion. "It was then I threw over religion altogether. For a couple of years now, a knife had meant more to me than religion. I had faith in my knife. It had saved me many times." Neither Patterson nor Conrad intended it that way, but Patterson's autobiography provided corroboration for Crenshaw and Miller, whose book, Scottsboro, the Firebrand of Communism, depicted a case as a communist plot to foment revolution in Alabama. The quote is from Carter, who dismisses the Crenshaw-Miller book as, quote, "intellectually dishonest," unquote, because the authors stacked the evidence in Victoria Price's favor. As we have already indicated, Crenshaw-Miller maintained that Crenshaw and Miller maintained that Price's moral stature was irrelevant to the case when clearly it was not. But the fact that they found themselves imprisoned by the South's sexual racial code does not change the fact that Crenshaw and Miller were right in seeing the Scottsboro case as a communist plot to foment revolution in Alabama, and another link in the chain of revolutionary, largely Jewish organizations that spent the better part of the 20th century trying to wean the Negro from Christ and turn him into a revolutionary. So again, this is Catholic Jones, who's acknowledging that even though these blacks in the South are not Catholic, they're Protestant Christians, Christianity offers a way for blacks and whites to get along, at least to some degree. And yet he's acknowledging that race was stronger than religion in those places because they were overwilling to look at the evidence that the women in question were prostitutes in order to protect their entire people from the blacks, who would maraud if they thought they had any chance of getting away with it, especially even apart from an outside of the Jewish outside interference, which was no little thing in these decades, since the Jews are the ones coming forward to defend these Negro rapists and murderers. Now, once it appeared in 1950, that is two decades after the case began and a decade after it's over, or 12 years after it's over, since it lasted from apparently 1931 to about 1938, once it appeared in 1950, Haywood Patterson's autobiography provided independent corroboration of Crenshaw and Miller's thesis when they wrote in 1936 that the Communist Party has seized upon this case for only one reason, to stir up race antagonism in the Black Belt of the South. Crenshaw and Miller cited as proof of ILD literature, which claimed that Crenshaw and Miller cited as proof ILD literature claiming that with the Scottsboro case, a spearhead we have been able to penetrate with the Scottsboro case as a spearhead, we have been able to penetrate broad masses of the Negro people and to extend our influence widely among them. We have been able to organize more than 6,000 Negro sharecroppers and a few hundred whites. Carter claims that information technology in particular, the pervasive sounds of images of radio and television, have destroyed the physical and intellectual environment that made the Scottsboro case so chillingly representative of Southern race relations. Racism and parochialism remain, but the rural and small town island community that existed in the 1930s has drastically shrunk. And again, the guy is saying this in 1950. He's saying that these new national mass media afford a way to break down the mentality of the South and to ensure that something like the Scottsboro Boys case never happens again, and that the communists can make their way. And today they're multiculturalists, but they make their way through these national media, which turn people into atomized individuals who know nothing but what they hear from the national intercom, the TV and the radio. And if we have control of these at the national level, we can destroy regionalism and help end the South and bring about the end of the white race, which only nuts and weirdos would resist, and haters and demagogues would resist, as Ignatieff said, the Jew who preaches the abolishment of the white race. And so, I'm going to read that again because I think it's important. This is the guy writing in 1950. Named Carter, and he's talking about the power of the mass media in a way that William Pierce might, you know, another 2-3 decades from then. He says, the pervasive sounds and images of radio and television have destroyed the physical and intellectual environment that made the Scottsboro case so chillingly representative of Southern race relations. Racism and parochialism remain, but the rural and small-town island community that existed in the 1930s has drastically shrunk. Jones continues, without understanding that the small-town island community might have solved its own problems on a local basis without the help of television or communist agitators. Well, obviously, they don't want the small town doing what's in the interest of the people who form those towns, the whites. They want them doing what's in the interest of the Jews. And that's worshiping niggers as football players and giving them their daughters. Crenshaw and Miller claim that the Tuskegee Institute has remained aloof from the Scottsboro case throughout its spectacular history. Whatever modus vivendi that had been attained was swept away by the communist deliberate attempt to foment racial antagonism and revolution. With one fell swoop, communism shattered a tranquility it had taken the black man's intellectual leadership half a century to achieve. That is, if whites and blacks were left alone in the South, in roughly equal numbers in a lot of areas, or at least with a very large black minority, they could find a way to work out their problems. And the way that they worked it out was through segregation and black self-help and genuine black nationalism. And physical separation and legal segregation. But all that was destroyed by Jews who had a different agenda and who had the power of the mass media and the bribing of mass politicians and the backing of Jew-dominated academia to sustain them. And to lead to victory over the white man, destroy the white man's culture. And that's exactly what has happened. And it was that easy. It took one case, and communist organizers going down there, spreading unhappiness and spreading insurrection, and backing that up with the northern papers and the northern media. That's all it took to get the process that we suffer from today underway. It wasn't just the communists, says Jones, who ensured that the South would be deprived of the opportunity to work out its own problems. The NAACP, the ILD's bitter antagonist in the Scottsboro Boys trials, used W.E.B. Du Bois to destroy the influence of Booker T. Washington, because Washington was insufficiently revolutionary in his orientation. And again, we talked about this last time. Washington's view was cast down your bucket. Be satisfied with what you can do and are able to do. Develop your skills. Keep your money in your own community, and in that way, win whatever political liberty you can from the white man who, after all, is naturally concerned with protecting his own. And Jones, the Catholic, not the white nationalist, is saying that the Jews deliberately set out, using their front men, W.E.B. Du Bois, operating through their false front, the NAACP, to destroy this school of black thought. Because he didn't preach integration. He didn't preach back to Africa. He preached black self-help and casting down your bucket where you are and being happy with being a hewer of wood and a drawer of water, because those were things you could do, rather than blame the white man for all your problems and for being the reason you can't be a lawyer when nature made these indelible idiocy of the black race into a limit on its capacity for social and intellectual development beyond the mud hut stage, as we see in Africa. Anyone willing to work together over the racial barriers on a local level was dismissed as an Uncle Tom by the New York Jews and their advocates in the sympathetic Eastern press, who more and more got to determine the terms of racial debate. Indeed, the conflict between the NAACP and the ILD, that is, the black front of the Jews and the communist front of the Jews, was a debate between two largely Jewish organizations over the best way to spread revolution in the South. So they both have the same end in mind. The fact that more people got lynched because of the Southern perception of outside influence was seen by moderates like those in the NAACP as unfortunate collateral damage, and by the radicals in the Communist Party as a positive benefit in radicalizing the Negro population as a whole. So yeah, they have to, you can't, you know, make an omelet without breaking eggs. You have to sacrifice a few individual niggers to get the mass of Negroes inflamed and demanding equal rights with a white man who's equal they are not. But which fact is concealed and lied about by Jews? Well, the type doing the agitation. As Lenin once said, things have to get worse before they get better. And the Crenshaw Miller recognized that the Scottsboro Boys were the first victims of the implementation of that strategy. Are the communists and their sympathizers even remotely interested in securing justice for the 9 Negro defendants? Or are they using them merely as tools to create animosity between the white and black races? The communists succeeded as well in exacerbating the antagonism between the North and the South, widening, quote, a breach between the North and the South that had been slowly vanishing since Reconstruction days, unquote. Friedman claims that the civil rights interests of Jews and blacks in the 1920s and 30s were virtually identical. Restating the same thesis in more modest form, Friedman adds that Jews who also benefited from Marshall's, that's the AJC had Lewis Marshall's, civil rights litigation did not minimize its usefulness for blacks. But in stating his case this way, Friedman ignores the fact that when Jewish agitators came to the South to promote revolution, it was the blacks who got lynched as a result of their actions. Conversely, when the Jews Shriftman and Cohn got caught trying to bribe Victoria Price, they did not have to hang around to face the consequences of their actions. After their arrest, they simply jumped bail and returned to New York City, knowing that the North had a long history of thwarting extradition requests whenever the case involved the race question. Friedman claims that the Black-Jewish alliance collapsed in the 1960s, but in doing so he ignores the fact that this feeling of resentment was growing around the time of the Scottsboro Boys trial when, quote, many Negroes felt, as they had in 1931, that once again the ILD was polishing up the electric chair for the Scottsboro Boys by insisting on linking their case with the overall program in the Communist Party. The Jews are always willing to sacrifice non-Jews to advance their Jewish agenda. And that goes for blacks as well as whites, as well as Asians, as well as Mexicans. If you're not a Jew, you don't matter, except insofar as you serve the Jews' purpose. And if black boys frying in the electric chair gets large numbers of Negroes riled up, then that's what needs to happen, because it's good for the Jews. And that's all that matters. The tensions which led to the collapse of the Black-Jewish alliance were already evident in the 30s, which Friedman attempts to portray as the golden age of their mutual collaboration. As some indication of the mounting tensions, W.E.B. Du Bois resigned from the board of the NAACP in 1934. Excuse me. Cruz claims that economics was the main reason. Du Bois, who had been the black face, just as George Bush might be the white face of the Jewish party today, Du Bois felt that NAACP leadership recoiled from any consideration of the economic plight of the world or any change in the organization of industry. But Jewish paternalism played a role as well. Du Bois, who was planning to visit Germany in 1935, now that is interesting. Du Bois, who was planning to visit Germany in 1935, reacted testily to Franz Boas's suggestion that he was going to be hornswoggled by being treated to the Nazi version of the Potemkin village. That is, a village in which the facades of well-kept and expensive houses are there, but behind them there's nothing. It's like a Hollywood sham village. And Franz Boas, of course, is the German Jew who came to America and created social anthropology and is primarily known as the Jew who spread the great lie that race does not exist. And so, when even the Jew's tool, Du Bois, eventually quits the NAACP because he sees it's not truly being used to help blacks who, in the Great Depression in the 1930s, need economic help, and, it looks like Germany's doing fairly well to pull out of this. Why don't I go over there and see what's going on? And the Jews say, oh, they're just going to show you a Potemkin village. The Jews don't care about him any more than he served their interests, and now he's not, so they're going to attack him. According to Harold Cruz, the black historian, the Black-Jewish alliance ended over 30 years before Murray Friedman said it did. It ended on March 19, 1935, when a young Puerto Rican was caught stealing a 10-cent penknife from a Jew-owned store on 125th Street in Harlem. Before long, black mobs began a rampage of destruction that lasted for days. Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, who was half-Jewish, went out of his way to deny that Jewish stores had been singled out, but as Cruz adds, it was clear that they had. So, I guess a black Puerto Rican steals a penknife from a Jew store in Harlem, and blacks end up rioting because they don't like how the Jews treat them. And that ended the Black-Jewish alliance in 1935, whereas the Jews claim it only ended in the 60s. Irving Horowitz, who lived in Harlem during the riots of 1935, claims that in public discourse this was all viewed as a black-white confrontation, but those of us who lived through the events of the Harlem riots knew better. It was really a black-Jewish confrontation. The riots were a black attack on Jews that resulted from years of pent-up resentment. The Harlem riots presented Jews and communists with a conundrum they could not solve. From the point of view of class warfare, the communists should have praised the Negroes for engaging in what looked like the long-awaited black insurrection. That is, if communists were true to their principles, they would have praised the blacks for rising up against the overclass. But because the communists were actually a front for Jews, they couldn't do that because the Black Riot was an attack on Jews. So communism is just another universalism like Catholicism meant to serve Jewish interests rather than the interests or principles it ostensibly forwards. Then AACP had no qualms about condemning the riots, but they... Wait. The communists should have praised the Negroes for engaging in what looked like the long-awaited black insurrection, but that would have meant turning their back on their fellow Jews. Then AACP had no qualms about condemning the riots, but they, like their counterparts in the 1960s, had no way of explaining why this insurrection took place in the North, where the Negro had comparatively more freedom. NACP, moreover, did not want to deal with an economic issue, especially when there was a Jewish subtext to these economic issues, as was the case in Harlem. Remember, Jews don't want economic solidarity among their competitors because that's the path they use to power. So they prefer an overt civil rights political orientation because that leaves blacks powerless, except insofar as they follow their Jewish master. Whereas if the blacks have money, then they have their own private power and they don't need the Jews to lead them. One standard for Jews, another standard for everybody else. Unlike the situation in the South, says Jones, which might have been solved at a local level if the antagonists had been left alone to work out their differences, the situation in Harlem was largely a product of the interaction between Jews and blacks on a local level. The Negroes of Harlem were not oppressed by Jim Crow laws. They were tired of being cheated by Jewish merchants. And Jones is about to give you an interesting little micro history that you're certainly not going to get in any public school talk about black riots or about blacks being mistreated. You only hear about whites mistreating blacks. You never hear about Jews mistreating blacks because Jews control the content of the textbooks used by your children if they're so unfortunate as to attend a public school. In his memoir about growing up as the son of a Jewish hardware store owner in Harlem, Irving Lewis Horowitz described the annual ritual. And again, this is a big name, very respectable Jew, and he's going to tell you how Jews actually think and act. Irving Lewis Horowitz described the annual ritual of cheating the Schwarzes. That's the Schwarzes, it originates in it's a Yiddish term based on the German term for black, Schwarz, like Schwarzwald, black forest. Schwarz means black in German. Schwarz, spelled slightly differently, means like nigger or black in Yiddish. Irving Lewis Horowitz described the annual ritual of cheating the Schwarzes when they came into his father's store to get their Christmas tree bulbs tested. Christmas, Horowitz tells us, was a special occasion on which my father wreaked his own revenge on Christendom by cheating black Christians. The scam, Horowitz continued, went like this. This is a quote from Horowitz. The unsuspecting customer would bring in all the light bulbs for testing. Each bulb would be placed against the side of the bulb tester rather than against the filament that would light up the bulb. The trick was easily learned and passed on to my mother, my sister, and me. So see, Jews really are. They're a genetic criminal clan. I became a master at the special bulb test. When the same bulbs were retested after the customer left, they almost always were found to be perfect, or at least good enough for resale. My father placed them into inventory and sold them as new. So the Jew is operating two scams. The black is bringing his bulbs for testing. The Jew is, oh, it's no good, you must buy new bulbs. And then he's selling to his white or his other customers, he's selling used bulbs as though they're new. There's no end to Jewish scams. That's what they are. They're a genetic criminal clan. The special bulbs were resold countless times each season. Hence, it was no accident that the volume of December bulb sales probably surpassed that of any other month. December profits also showed remarkably uncharacteristic good health. 'Twas indeed the season to be merry. So the Jew's laughing at the shenanigans. He's unembarrassed about the criminal activity carried on by his Jewish father, who's in retail, and indeed their entire Jewish clan. Harold Cruz never mentions whether he had his Christmas bulbs tested by the Horowitz family. Harold Cruz being the black historian whose work is used a lot by Michael Jones. The prospect seems unlikely because by the 1930s, Cruz had committed himself to the communist cause. Cruz's resentment goes deeper than the few cents here and there with which the Jewish merchants gouged out of their black clientele. He felt that the Jews stole the Negro cultural heritage by promoting their form of jazz as the authentic form and freeing Negroes like Cruz, who spent the 50s unsuccessfully trying to get his musicals produced on Broadway out of the cultural picture. So just as they're taking over the political leadership of the black, they're taking over any of their cultural forms and turning them to their own profit, political and financial. As a Jew growing up in Harlem who attended jazz concerts at the Apollo Theater with his sister, Horowitz was close enough to the situation to see the resentment it caused in people like Cruz. Horowitz says, Jewish musicians, Goodman, Gershwin, Mesrow, and Whiteman, among others, not only played the music, but it served as critics and interpreters. In a racially controlled pre-war America, it was the Jew who popularized black life, just as they do with hip-hop today. They did with jazz yesterday, transforming a folk tradition into an art mode. Although the close proximity of blacks and Jews in Harlem allowed for a rich cross-fertilization of cultures, it also engendered feelings of rivalry and resentment. It seemed that the gain and fame of their culture went to the accursed Jewish cultural middleman, while the purity of their performance remained undersupported and undernourished. So he's saying, once again, blacks, Jews are stealing the black man's culture and selling it to a profit, at a profit to whites. And again, this is what Jews have done with hip-hop. The Jews, of course, had worries of their own, seeing this flirtation with black culture as nothing short of a desecration of Jewish life, an early warning signal that sexuality would displace marriage and undiluted individual expression would destroy family solidarity. In Harlem, Jews and Negroes shared the bitter taste of poverty and little else. Horowitz describes his father as an anti-Jewish Jew living in a world of pious Christian blacks. His father's religion was communism, something Horowitz described as, quote, a religion without Christ and a, quote, a church without a crucifix, which allowed him to live in the imaginary world of Jewish Bundism and Russian Bolshevism. The irony, of course, is that on the practical level, Horowitz's pair, Horowitz the father, had to live the life of the petty Calvinist capitalist, which Marx had criticized in his essay on the Jewish question. Horowitz was a loser simply by the fact that he came from Harlem. The Jews of Harlem, if my extended family was any barometer, were viewed as dregs, social scourges and economic failures simply by virtue of the fact that they remained. Harlem was the settlement village for Jews completely without money. But as the century progressed, and Jews, unlike blacks, were able to move out of Harlem, the resentment began to build. Then all of the submerged tension erupted in the Harlem riots of 1935 and the Jewish-black antagonism that the Jewish at organizations like the NAACP and the AJC had been trying to ignore was suddenly out in the open. Says Horowitz, shopkeepers were the visible enemies. For black militants, they were the devil whites. For other blacks, Jews ascendant or ghetto profiteers, the Merchant of Venice had come to Harlem. The chemistry was rife for rioting. World War II brought an end to depression everywhere but Harlem, or so it seemed. Chain stores left the area, small shopkeepers followed, and service persons who fixed window panes and repaired locks vanished. The Harlem community was left in charge of itself. It was a self that turned out to be an empty shell, at least for the duration of the war. The riots followed by the war, which provided Horowitz's father with a job at the Brooklyn Navy Yard as a third-class mechanics apprentice, meant that it was time to leave. We surveyed the wreckage, Horowitz writes. With a few tears, my father simply announced, it's over. We move on now. So the Jews cheated the blacks for years, and the blacks wound up rioting, and that caused the last of the Jews to leave Harlem. More than anything, the riots showed that the so-called black-Jewish alliance was largely a fiction in the collective mind of the organizations which promoted it. The organizations were largely Jewish, and they promoted the alliance as a way of securing Jewish interests. But ultimately, there was no alliance, because ultimately, where blacks and Jews lived together, there was no community. Unlike the South, Jews and blacks in the North simply lived near each other in the same neighborhood for a number of years, without community, without shared affection, without love, says Jones, and he's quoting, without community, without shared affection, without love. So he's saying the blacks and whites, because they aren't filled with hatred the way Jews are, found a way to live together that involved some interaction, but it kept them separate on the stuff where they couldn't get along. But the Jews and the blacks, despite all their protestations of having an alliance, well, the protestations were coming from the Jews, and in fact, there was no alliance. They didn't like the blacks. They had no affection for them. There was no love there, and there was no real community there. It's just a bunch of political lies intended to advance the Jewish agenda and put forth by organizations ostensibly representing others, but really and truly and only representing Jews. Cruz feels that the gross imbalance between the comparative economic status of blacks and Jews is what nullified the Black-Jewish alliance. Cruz says, the Black-Jewish alliance collapsed in 1935 and entered a state of disintegration, leading to the 1960 era with its rise in vocal black anti-Semitism. In 1935, the Harlem racial uprising, directed at white economic exploitation, white shopkeepers, white landlords, and white organized crime, was also directed at Jewish shopkeepers, businessmen, and landlords. The Jews, according to Cruz, used the civil rights movement to absolve themselves from the charges that the Jew was greedy. The Jews, according to Cruz, used the civil rights movement to absolve themselves from the charges that the Jew was a, quote, greedy, clannish miser, always out for himself. The Harlem Uprising, according to Cruz, was able to shatter the flimsy premises on which the Black-Jewish alliance had rested because the Jews had undermined by their behavior and their inability to face up to any negative criticism. No matter how much the story of Horowitz's father repeated itself in the lives of ordinary blacks, the Jews controlled the press, which meant that in the final analysis, they could prove themselves generous, selfless, tolerant, and humanitarian. So, basically, in this article by a Catholic, we have him quoting a black saying essentially the exact same thing that white nationalists say about Jews. So Catholics, blacks, and white nationalists all say the same thing about the Jew, even if they have different solutions. The point is the Jew is the one causing all of these problems and these frictions between people. He's exacerbating the natural differences where they will serve him, and he's covering up those natural differences where it's to his advantage to pretend that they don't exist. And he's undermining anyone, black or white, who would defend their communities by advancing their true interests, which lie in separation, whether by ocean or simply by law, if they have to live together for a time in a space. That's what has to be understood here. The Jew is the problem. And there's just a little more, and the article is done. A few more paragraphs, but Jones says, Marcus Garvey, and remember the exponent of black nationalism and the Backed Africa movement, who got together thousands of blacks and set up a black shipping line and encouraged blacks to find economic solidarity with one another. Marcus Garvey died in England on June 10, 1940, and with him died, at least for the time being, the idea of black nationalism. During the 40s, Harlem was awash in conflicting ideological currents. Communism went into decline after 1946 to be replaced by the ascendancy of the integrationism of the NAACP, which is just communism by a different form, in the form of multiculturalism. The fact remains, as black historian Cruz points out, that Jews and organizations like the NAACP remain pro-integrationist for Negroes and anti-assimilationist for Jews. One standard for Jews, another standard for everybody else. You must integrate with the whites. It will destroy the whites, and it will help us. But we will not assimilate to white culture. We will remake America in our interests. And we will lie about what it is. And we will lie about who created it. We'll lie about who is an American, what is an American. And when we get enough, we get the borders open, we let in the third world, eventually we'll call whites un-American if they try to protect their interests. We'll call them haters. We'll call them segregation. We'll denounce them. So even the black observes Jews are pro-integrationist for Negroes, yet anti-assimilationist for Jews. One standard for them, another standard for us. Since ethnicity in America, according to Cruz's reading of the theory known as the triple melting pot, is synonymous with religion. Since ethnicity in America is synonymous with religion, integration for the Negro meant that he would remain as an ethnic anomaly, cut off from any grouping which could give him real political, economic, or cultural power. Exactly what the Jews are trying to do to the whites as well as the blacks, by calling us haters if we try to protect ourselves. When he ponders the insistence of Jewish sociologists like the neocon Nathan Glazer, who wrote one of the first books against affirmative action back in the 1970s, that Negroes be integrated as fast as possible and by any means, that's a Jewish so-called right-winger saying that, Negroes must be integrated as fast as possible and by any means, black historian Cruz discerns no benevolence, not even misguided benevolence, and that's correct, but rather the fact that, quote, today's Negroes truly have a Jewish problem, unquote. The main problem is that, quote, as a Jew, Nathan Glazer could be said to be most magnanimously free with other people's ethnicity. Jews want to destroy all competing ethnic groups and racial groups by mixing them together and forcing them to submit to Jewish overlordship, destroying all their cultural patterns and mixing their genes until they no longer know what they are. That's exactly what Jews are trying to do. That's called genocide. And even a black can see that, as well as the white nationalists. And unlike the so-called, the fake opposition, the conservatives who always, oh, we're not racist, oh, look how many blacks we have speaking. The only way to defend yourself is to do that, to defend yourself. We don't need any defense. We need to attack the people who are attacking us. We don't have to, we're not, we want to be white. We're proud of being white. We like being white. We're happy with being white. And we don't need any further explanation or defense than that. We need to take care of the people who are attacking us. That's where our concerns need to lie. As communism waned and Zionism took its place as the dominant vehicle of Jewish messianic politics in the latter part of the 20th century, the suspicion would grow that the Jews, says Jones, were interested in integration for every group but itself. Exactly, exactly right. The corollary to that belief was that Jewish organizations could attack both black and white nationalists as racists at the same time that Israel promoted the same sort of apartheid. Again, one standard for Jews, another standard for everybody else, as I said about 10 years ago. I've never ceased repeating because it's correct. This double standard was covered over during the 50s and 60s by the successes of the civil rights movement, but it would reassert itself with a vengeance by the time the 20th century came to a close, concludes Jones. And that's how it is. The Jews are pushing one standard for themselves and another standard for everybody else, and they don't care who gets raped, murdered, killed, or sliced up. As long as it's good for Jews, that's the only thing that matters to them. That's the kind of people that we're dealing with. They're not like us. They don't belong to us. Jews anywhere are a threat to whites everywhere because they work together as a team to squash our interests and to genocide our race. And that's where we're going to leave it for today, September 11th, 2008. And we'll be back on Tuesday. Topic unsure, but it'll probably be more of the same. With more history and more news articles talking about the condition of the white man in the 21st century. What we have to do to regain our corporate integrity. The South used to think of itself as a nation and a people, and it needed to protect itself. And if it had to sacrifice a few Negroes, that the rest not be free to maraud, well, that was okay. And I agree, and that's the kind of thinking we have to get back to, but we have to get back to it through the modern mechanisms of mass media and through political control. If you don't control your own media, you don't control your community. And a tiny alien parasitic hostile outside elite is going to speak for you in your name and teach your youth to believe things that will destroy itself. That's what the Jews are doing with the media, and that's why they need to be dealt with. Again, this is Radio Estina. I'm Alex Linder. I'm signing off for September 11, 2008. This has been Radio Estina number 24. All of these are recorded and archived for your convenience at vnnforum.com, which we hope you'll join. It's a good, serious forum. And we also have govnn.com and vanguardnewsnetwork.com. We've been around for over 9 years now, bringing the truth about what's going on over the Internet to white people. Thanks for listening. We hope you pass this on. I'm going to play No, you know what? I'm not going to play any songs right now. I'm just going to sign off. Next time when we come on, we'll probably have a little music on Tuesday earlier. But again, thanks for listening.